Today on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, we know Trump is a germaphobe, but is he taking spring cleaning to an extreme with McMaster out, Bolton in as the new national security advisor? What does this mean for North Korea and the Iran deal? Meet the Press's Chuck Todd joins us for that and his take on who would win the schoolyard brawl, Trump or Joe Biden. From there, we open up the lines and ask you if you're ready to be dragged into the gutter by way of two back-to-back TV interviews with alleged mistresses of Donald Trump. Then Jason Margolis from PRI's The World joins us for another installment from his series, 50 States, a Cross-Country Look at How Globalism is Affecting America.
At noon, Emily Rooney is here for her famous list of fixations and fulminations. Then Maura Healey joins us for another edition of Ask the AG, taking our questions and yours. That and more is coming up on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Eastern Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Friday. We are at the Boston Public Library in the corner of Exeter and Boylston Street in the Back Bay. Hello again, Jim.
Hey there, Marjorie. So Trump's self-liberation from firing Andrew McCabe to forcing the resignation of his personal lawyer, John Dowd, is coming at a precarious time. Yesterday, Meet the Press Daily broke news that this latest legal shakeup is because Trump's impulses against the advice of his lawyers is to go to war with Robert Mueller. If this interview between the two does happen, will it be more like Frost-Nixon or Rumble with a special counsel? Whatever it is, if we're a pay-per-view, it would probably pay off the nation's debt. Meet the Press Daily's Chuck Todd joins us online for his take on this, the ongoing spring cleaning at the White House with the ouster of McMaster and more. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. And, of course, he's the political director of NBC News. Hey there, Chuck Todd.
How you doing?
Excellent.
Well, we're sort of, there was so much to talk about. We didn't really know where to begin, but why not begin with...
I don't know either.
I know. But why not begin...
Trade war. Don't forget the trade war.
Oh, yeah.
Bring that up.
Yep. A trade war, guns, Karen McDougal, Pompeo, Bolton. But we're going to start with John Dowd. So that does seem to make sense that this is a mano a mano with Robert Mueller.
Well, you know, actually, I'm going to connect John Dowd and Henry McMaster and John Bolton and Joe DiGenova. The president is basically firing people that he doesn't like their advice and hiring people that are giving him the advice that he wants, right? His lawyers, he views the interview with Mueller as a way to wrap up the Mueller investigation. I think one of the disconnects here is, like, that's why the president's so anxious. He figures the longer he goes without actually doing the interview with Mueller, the longer the investigation goes. So he's now hiring people to advise him on what he already wants to do.
Well, I guess that, I mean, the idea of, okay, he's been in the job for a year. He was a little insecure. Now he's been in the job. He feels like he can trust his instincts and all that. But, you know, we have been saying for more than a year now, Chuck Todd, that one of the saving graces of the Trump presidency, if you're nervous about his impulsiveness, is the so-called adults in the room, McMaster being one of the last. And now with Bolton being there, who's a definite hawk, who, correct me if I'm wrong, has not even admitted being wrong about the weapons of mass destruction in the Iraq War, has been very hawkish toward Korea.
And Iran,
exactly. Let's get out of the Iran deal. Let's have a limited war with North Korea, whatever that means. We have Trump kind of unharnessed, I guess.
You do. I mean, and that's the thing. I mean, I think, look, I don't know if Trump and Bolton see eye to eye on the world, but they see eye to eye on Iran. And this president is making a decision in the moment. He's not thinking about 6 months from now. He's not thinking about a year from now. He's thinking about the moment. And Iran is in the moment. So, look, you bring up an important point about John Bolton. John Bolton is probably among the, you talk to anybody, both detractors and supporters, and they'll say he's probably the smartest person in the national security space there is. And it's his competency that scares those that don't support him, because he knows how to get his policies implemented. He knows how to, but the biggest downside to him that you hear, the biggest detraction you hear, is he's never been persuaded to another position, meaning he's never believed he's been wrong about anything. And that is, you know, you don't that usually isn't the sign of a good advisor if they can't be persuaded to a decision that they didn't agree with at first.
Chuck, how do you think Brian Kilmeade will be as Secretary of Defense? Do you think he's up to the job? Can we get back to
Bolton? What?
What's that?
I take Kilmeade over Ducey at Defense.
Can we get back to Bolton for a second? Everybody's got their different reasons for anxiety here, if you're not crazy about the choice. And I think your assessment that he's the smartest guy in the room is the consensus thing. Did he not write something, a month or so ago, saying that he thought a conventional war with North Korea could actually be pulled off? And how does that...
Yeah, look,
Go ahead.
He believes in regime change. No. He believes he does believe that the military is part of the diplomatic toolbox. Now, he's not alone in that, but he believes in it as not as a tool of last resort, but as a tool of the trade. And that the best way to get the North Koreans to negotiate on your terms is to blow up a reactor. Or the best way to get the Iranians to negotiate is to get rid of a reactor. Send a message. So that's what he's an advocate of. For years, he's been an advocate of this type of foreign policy, more aggressive foreign policy for years. And there's been people above him to check his instinct.
Well,
nobody to check him.
I don't understand this. If we've had all these people there to check his instincts, and yet he's the smartest guy in the room, then why don't we just start blowing everything up if he's so smart?
Well, I think that when it comes to Bolton, you brought up the WMD thing.
Right.
You know, the reason he doesn't believe Iraq was a mistake is that he was an advocate of the regime change. WMD was just a way to sell it.
We're talking to Chuck Todd from Meet the Press. Now, Chuck, I'm very proud to say I watched all 9 hours of the Karen McDougal interview last night on CNN. Is it beyond the sensational, almost appalling stuff here? I guess there are two issues. One, does this and Stormy Daniels to come, we don't know what the deal is going to be Sunday night, have any impact on Donald Trump's standing? And two, is the only issue... really of concern to the public as to whether or not the money that was transferred to these two people may have been illegal campaign contributions? Is there another issue other than the salaciousness of both these situations?
Look, I think it's I think it is the campaign finance and the blackmail possibility, right? If it's these two, how many others, is there? I think it does sort of, it could certainly inform circumstantially this idea that, his carelessness in his personal life, does that expose him, right? If you think about the so-called dossier allegations and things like that. But look, I continue to believe, and I don't think it's an accident, that on the eve of these interviews about to go public, you've got word that Melania is telling people how unhappy she is, telling People magazine how unhappy she is. I think the biggest danger here for the president is personal isolation, and is this basically blowing up his marriage? I think that's why he's been so panicked about this. I think this is he's acting very rationally, as you would assume any man would act when they're about to have their paramours go public and they don't want their wife to hear.
I don't want to turn you into Dr. Ruth here or anything, because that Chuck Todd. But you also hear a lot of people saying that the difference between Gary Hart's wife, Hillary Clinton, the wives of all these other people that have been philanderers, is that that she's the only one we really think that got into this knowing what she was getting into kind of deal. That Melania probably knew that makes her a little bit less sympathetic than, that when you saw, I'll never forget, this is a long time ago, I'm dating myself, but Gary Hart's wife, Lee, standing next to him when he was confronting me,
I remember that.
Looking like she was about to fall apart right there on stage. You know what I mean?
Well, and remember, people used to say about Hillary Clinton, she knew what she was getting into.
Yes.
I have to tell you, I've had a long conversation, and look, I'm gonna let my wife play Dr. Ruth here.
Okay.
I've had this conversation with her, and she says, nobody gets into these things to be humiliated.
Yeah.
You may think you know what you're getting into, but do you think the deal was? And by the way, I'm going to make sure you're publicly humiliated because my sex life is going to get dragged out on the tablet. Mm-hmm. You think Melania signed up for that?
Yeah,
right.
Well, that's
like
a good point.
That's the way my wife puts it. And I, you know, it's like she's right. She's like, it's like it doesn't matter what you think. Nobody wants to be humiliated in public like this. And that's what this ultimately is. It doesn't matter. He did this while she was pregnant. He did this while she just had a child. You know,
right. That
you know she may realize she may have thought, yeah, Donald Trump wasn't going to be the guy to change diapers. But maybe she didn't think he was going to do that in that moment.
We're talking to Chuck Todd from Meet the Press. Hey, Chuck, tomorrow we're broadcasting from the library here mm-hmm. in downtown Boston, the Boston version of.
By the way, I could tell you guys are whispering. You guys are quiet. You're not going at each other.
That's right.
I can sort of say you're in the library. You're very well behaved.
Thank you very much.
The librarian is making sure we don't get out of order over here. She's pointing at
totally
us.
Totally could tell that. Yeah,
exactly.
I bet. Get that loudmouth out of here.
Actually, Marjorie said that. It wasn't the librarian.
Oh, okay.
The March for Our Lives, the Boston version, is going to happen literally about a block. We're going to do a broadcast from here tomorrow. Yesterday, the vice president was in New Hampshire congratulating his boss for being about to sign a $2 billion school security measure, fixing NICS, as they say, the so-called criminal background check system, not expanding background checks. Regardless of how successful the march in D.C. and the 800 others around the country and some around the world are tomorrow, Congress is done with gun control for this session. Is that not a fair statement?
Yeah, it's a totally fair statement. But, you know, they did make extraordinarily incremental progress, meaning it was very incremental, but it was incremental. I mean, just simply the research issue alone, we may look back in 10 years and say, okay, that was an important step. Allowing research. So I wouldn't, you know, yes, but I do think sentiments are changing a little bit here. I think the idea of regulating is opening more minds. So I think it's, you know, I wouldn't judge success or failure on this Congress and whether they act. I'd judge success or failure in the next 10 years.
Well, you know something, Chuck Todd, it was really interesting. The Boston Globe reported on this, and the Washington Post has reported on this, too. All these kids up there outside the Smith & Wesson factory in Springfield, and that's where the gun was made that was used in the Parkland shooting, the AR-15, and it was talking about the problem, which is that Smith & Wesson employs a lot of these kids' parents, and Springfield is a struggling city with a high unemployment rate, and yet they were out there, and that's something really new that that I haven't seen before, is people really, and this is not the first time this has happened since Parkland, that people have been outside of Smith & Wesson. So you wonder whether these teenagers, voters soon, can maybe turn things around, particularly if there's a gerrymandering change. I don't know if I'm being too hopeful, but...
I think targeting the gun manufacturers is an interesting idea as well, because you know, for a gun discussion for this Sunday, I went up to Madison, Wisconsin. There's a great group there that after the whole Skywalker recall, a group of concerned citizens, liberal and conservative, said, you know what, we need to start talking to each other again. So it's an ideological group that tries to debate issues and solve problems. And so we tackled the gun issue. And what I found interesting is, somebody brought up, why don't gun manufacturers, do they care about their future customer base here? Like, why don't they, like, do stuff like, you know, worry about gun safety? And don't they want their guns to be operated properly? And don't they, you know, don't they want to be part of or at least act like they want to be part of the solution here? And it was an interesting, like, you're right. You don't even see a gun manufacturer come out and say, if you have a gun in your home, be sure to lock it up if you have kids in the house. You know, you don't. They don't do things like that. They do no goodwill for their community. And that's something you wonder, at a minimum, do these kids protesting the gun manufacturers make these executives say, you know what, maybe we ought to at least pretend we're concerned citizens here.
You know, speaking of Sunday, we usually talk to you on Thursdays, not Fridays. Do you know anything else about your show on Sunday, or is that it for now?
I do. I'm going to talk to Mark Warner on the Facebook Russia issue.
Great.
And I'm going to talk to Corey Lewandowski on, because it looks like the Trump that he worked for is back.
You know, before you go, we know you're a big sports fan. Do you agree with the president that Joe Biden would go down fast and hard, crying all the way? Which side are you on in that fight there, Chuck Todd?
You know, it's interesting. I think Biden is more like a Sugar Ray Leonard.
Exactly.
He's gonna dance in the rain.
Yeah, yeah.
I think Trump is more like George the Animal Steel. Remember him from wrestling? He might rip the turnbuckle off, but forget to actually punch Biden. But he'll go after that turnbuckle, and he'll rip it apart.
Yeah.
You know, I think Biden's nimbleness and speed, I'm betting on that. Although, I assume Trump is like a one-punch guy.
Yeah.
He could be Buster Douglas.
That's brilliant.
He's going to swing one, so don't get in the way of it.
I'll tell you, no one has insight quite like you, Chuck Todd. I'll tell you.
Chuck,
hey,
thank
Chuck,
you.
It's great to talk
thank
to you.
Thank you very much. Looking forward
to
this
guys.
Sunday.
We'll be watching Sunday.
Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press. We just mentioned it. You can catch it Sunday mornings, 10:30 on NBC Boston, which is now Channel 10 on most providers around here. And he's also the host every afternoon of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC on Channel 37 on most outlets around here. Chuck Todd is also the political director
15
for NBC
minutes or so.
News. Coming up, we are asking you, how low as a nation can we go with back-to-back TV exclusives with the alleged mistresses of Donald Trump? Are you taking in the salacious details or not? We're asking you next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. To mark the 20th anniversary of the Clinton-Lewinsky affair, the Universe is delivering a double feature this week with two of Trump's alleged mistresses. Excuse me. We have last night's CNN interview with Karen McDougal. As I said, the Chuck is about 6 hours long. I watched all 6 hours. It was long, Marjorie.
It was long.
And this Sunday's 60 Minutes exclusive with Stormy Daniels. If you still have a bad aftertaste from the Clinton Lewinsky thing, from the blue dress to the cigar, Linda Tripp's twisted phone calls, Betty Curry's unfortunate cameo, these interviews will do nothing to cleanse your palate. From gratuitous questions about condoms, and I love Anderson Cooper, but really, and gag-inducing references to Ivanka Trump, we're asking you if you're taking it all in anyway. 877-301-8970. Earlier this week, we were talking to Harvard behavioral economist Michael Norton about how we are wired, remember this, Marjorie, to converge to the lowest common denominator. Are you already feeling the gravitational pull into the other bowels of society? 877-301-897. Did you watch the whole thing?
Absolutely, from beginning to end.
I mean,
and, you know, I kind of thought it was going to end at 9 o'clock because he has a show from 8 to 9 and 9 to 10, and that they would have the analysis at 9. But it kept on going right through
endless.
9 o'clock. It went on until about, what, 9:30 practically?
You know, and again, I want to, the last time I'll say, I'm a huge Anderson Cooper fan.
Yep.
He's my favorite person, best interviewer on late night cable or nighttime cable. But, you know, other than the issue which you and I were discussing this morning, and I think we broached with Chuck, the whole question of whether or not the 150 grand that was paid by
grand
the National
for
Inquirer,
National Inquirer that's correct.
To Karen
McDougal. She was
the
supposed to get a fitness column
right.
and a beauty column, and they kind of shafted her.
But a catch and kill. We take
catch
the story and then we kill the story.
Correct.
And then the 130,000.
Because Mr. Pecker is a very good friend of Donald
the
Trump's, the aptly named head of the National
Beautifully
Inquirer.
Put. And 130 grand from Michael Cohen, the lawyer for personal lawyer for Trump,
right.
to Stormy Daniels. There obviously is at least a legit issue as to whether or not they're illegal campaign contributions. For those who don't know, I hope I get this right. I think you're allowed to give $5,400, I think, a year to a federal candidate directly. And you can give unlimited amounts to these independent expenditure groups, but only if it's not coordinated with the candidate or the campaign. You might argue that if Michael Cohen, is Michael Cohen is his first name? Michael Cohen
Jim,
is involved,
Jim,
it's coordinated
Jim,
with the candidate.
Nobody is watching this about the campaign
I know,
contribution
it's pathetic,
angle.
But I felt dirty actually watching the whole thing.
Well, you know what she was, though? She was totally believable.
No, I don't mean, I wasn't being critical of her. I'm being critical of me.
Okay.
And the media. I mean, that could have been a 10-minute interview. And Stormy Daniels, I assume, is going to be 9 hours long, too.
Haven't you ever heard sex sells, Jim? Have you never heard that?
877-301-8970. So did you watch, and what was your reaction to this? And are you going to watch Stormy Daniels. And, you know, by the way, one last thing about
what
this.
What is Stormy going to do really to top this?
What's that?
I mean, what is Stormy going to do to top this? It's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult.
Maybe she'll come on with these straps that she was wearing during the lie detector
test. I think it will have a different flavor to it because Karen McDougal was talking about being in love with the president, even thinking about marrying the president. She was talking about being fairly guilty. So, you know, you give her that. I mean,
Did you see Maggie Haberman last night from the New York Times?
Yes, I did.
Maggie Haberman said, and this is a real serious journalist, that she had heard from some sources that the reason that the president of the United States announced his new national security advisor, John Bolton, when he did yesterday afternoon, which supposedly was not going to happen yesterday afternoon, why was it? It was allegedly because he wanted to distract attention away from the McDougal interview. How frightening is that?
Maggie Haberman knows a lot more than I do about Donald Trump. She's covered him for the New York Times. She covered his campaign. But you know something? I would beg to disagree on this one. I think his base that he worries about
doesn't care at all.
Are you kidding? They love this. Yeah. They're looking at this woman who's a gorgeous-looking woman who was Playmate of the Year, whatever she was, talking about how she fell in love with the president, how she met him at a Playboy mansion party by the pool with Hugh Hefner and all these beautiful women out there at the Playboy mansion. I mean, they're thinking this guy is totally living the dream writ large, at least the men. Maybe some of the women would feel bad because Melania Trump just had a baby. And even though Melania Trump, as we just discussed with Chuck Todd, knew what she was buying into, she didn't expect this kind of constant, endless humiliation, which is what she's facing right now. Because she talked last night about the president showing her Melania's room, which was a little bit too far.
By the way, did you see the note that one of our coworkers just typed us?
What?
Did you guys see that Daniel's lawyer tweeted a photo of a DVD in a safe with a comment? Talk about getting even lower. Quote, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, how many words is this worth? So what is there, a sex tape?
I think the only way that Stormy can top Karen is with pictures. I mean, I think that's what it's about, Jim. And let's hope there are pictures, because I don't think this is going to hurt the president one single solitary bit. I think people expected this from Donald Trump. He's not Miss Mitt Romney. As Matt Visor points out today in the Boston Globe, what was the biggest scandal of Mitt Romney's entire career?
The dog on the roof.
That he strapped the dog. Seamus on the roof when he drove to some vacation. And the poor dog, the Irish Setter, was on the roof and kept having accidents on the roof because he was traumatized and petrified. And what did Mitt do about it? He took Seamus off at the gas station,
hosed down
the roof, and put the dog right back up there.
By the way, since Marjorie and I dirtied ourselves by watching this whole thing last night, why don't we just include you as well? Here is Karen McDougal. I can't believe you even asked this question. Apologizing in response to a question, Anderson Cooper said, if Melania Trump is watching, what do you want to do? What do you want to say? Well, here she is apologizing to President's wife.
If Melania Trump is watching this, what would you want her to know?
It's a tough one.
Or say to her.
Yeah, what can you say except, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I wouldn't want it done to me.
Oh, that's it. Oh, sorry. I didn't know there was an extra sorry in there. Let's take some phone calls. Take the pressure off ourselves.
She's exactly right, Jim. What else can you say? There's nothing else to say, but I'm sorry.
Dave from Lexington, you are first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call. Hi, Dave.
Hello, this is Steve. Steve from Lexington.
Sorry,
oops.
Our fault.
Yeah.
Go, Steve.
Hi. So, you know, I watched the entire 9 hours of the
That's three of us.
Show. Right. It's just like it was the... Yeah, I was pulling my hair out at the end of it, and you know, going back to the you know, the Clinton era, as Todd was talking about, you know, it's, you know, a close friend of mine was Hillary's roommate at Wellesley.
Oh, really?
Oh, you're kidding?
Yeah, and still very good friends with her.
Huh.
And you know, she numerous times said she completely knew about Hillary knew all about all the philandering. But did not know about the Monica Lewinsky. She sort of drew the line when it was happening in the Oval Office. And that's what... Steve, let me just say,
and thank you for your call. I've said this 1,000 times in the air, so I'll say 1,001. I don't care what any of these people do in their private lives. That's between the couple.
I'm not done.
I haven't finished a sentence.
That drives me nuts.
If.
That's not true.
If As Chuck Todd said, there's a blackmail issue. If there's a legality issue, as I think there is in both of these payments, vis-a-vis, then it's relevant. Why am I wrong
because
beyond that?
Because it's totally sexist.
Why?
If this were a woman that was carrying on with porn stars, are you kidding me? You would say that's she doesn't belong in office. We just saw the mayor of Nashville, a woman resign. She lost her child, by the way, in an opioid.
I know that.
She's had the worst tragedy ever. She lost her child. She had an affair with her bodyguard. You might say that this woman was out of her mind with grief over losing her child.
Why is it our business?
But she's resigned.
Why is it
because
our business
there is
that Donald Trump had a relationship with a playmate and a porn star 10 years ago?
I'll take the feminist argument.
What's that?
That pornography does a great disservice to women. That women do not become porn stars, and I'm sorry, well, people will write and say I'm wrong, but I just respectfully disagree. You don't grow up wanting to become a porn star.
So that's
there's
on Donald Trump
amiss.
Because he had an affair?
He should not be having affairs with porn stars.
He shouldn't be,
right.
But the question is, how much of it is our business?
Because if you're the president of the United States, and
he
Bill
wasn't
Clinton,
president of the United States.
And Bill Clinton
Excuse
was
me, Bill
just
Clinton,
as bad, by the way,
Bill
if not worse.
Bill Clinton was president. Donald Trump was not. By the way, I'm not defending Trump, believe me.
Yes.
However, it was 10 years before he was even running.
Yeah,
the payoffs were not, but the sex was.
Well, I think that presumes that Donald Trump has not done anything during the campaign. We don't know about that. I would suspect that there are more women that we don't know about.
Maybe.
But the reason this issue is because when you're the president of the United States, you're making laws having to do with women and sex harassment and investigations of all these things. You should not be carrying on with Playboy bunnies and hookers, and you shouldn't be doing what Bill Clinton was doing either, which is sowing such disrespect for women that he was looking for women to bring to his hotel room for basically a 10-minute interlude.
How about
JFK? He's just as bad. JFK was just as bad.
Okay.
I mean, the only ones I would defend are people like Dwight Eisenhower, because Dwight Eisenhower was in the middle of World War II, and he had this absolutely drop-dead, knockout chauffeur, Kay Summersby, who drove him around all the time.
Okay.
He was far away from Mamie.
Oh my God. He thought
he could be dead at any moment. I forgive a little bit. And Franklin Roosevelt, it was a little bit different. But you know what you could say about Donald Trump after last night?
No.
He sounded like that he cared for this woman, which is more than you can say for Bill Clinton.
I don't care about that either.
Well, I'm just pointing these
things out,
Jim.
So why'd you watch the whole thing, Jim, if you don't care about any of this? That's an excellent question. Jeff and Braintree, you are next on Boston Public Radio from the Boston Public Library. Welcome.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Huge fan. First-time caller.
Thank you for both.
So, anyway, I work in a warehouse, and I meet some pretty interesting characters day-to-day. And we had a guy come in and work on our forklift the other day. And I heard he had his phone set to some radio program. I believe it was Rush Limbaugh or something.
Yep.
And I don't know. It was incredibly disturbing to me because we're talking about Stormy Daniels and how in a previous interview that she had with someone or another, I wasn't paying too close attention. All that they could comment on was how she was dressed and showing too much cleavage and whatnot. And I just find that the body shaming such as that, if that's the only thing that you can talk about, how can we have a reasonable conversation about these types of things?
Obviously, you know, the goal of those who are blind supporters of this president or blind supporters of Bill Clinton a couple of decades ago is, what was the great horrible line from James Carville? You drag a
dollar through a trailer park. What do you expect?
So yeah, I mean, so the goal is they're not only liars, but they're disgusting. The women are disgusting human beings. And obviously neither Bill Clinton nor Donald Trump would ever have anything to do with people like that. And the goal, I would assume, of Rush Limbaugh, I didn't hear it, is as much as you can discredit both personally and in any other way, Stormy Daniels, you are theoretically buttressing the case of your guy.
But I would disagree with you, Jeff, on one thing. I do think it's a sad state of affairs that women go to these ridiculous lengths to basically disfigure themselves because that's what the porn industry wants them to look like.
But that was not Rush Limbaugh's point, if he was making that point. You think Rush Limbaugh was concerned? No, but he was upset about body surgery. Do you think that's what his angle was?
No. But I'm saying, I don't know that body shaming in her situation exactly works. Because of what she does for a living.
Okay, here's our buddy Sean from Dedham. Sean, you are next on Boston Public Radio. How you doing, Sean?
Hey, guys. How are you? Guys, I'm always amazed. The media, you guys are involved in that.
We are.
The media props up Donald Trump all during the election period. They went to every one of his rallies live. They knew he was ratings. He was a ratings gold. Now all of a sudden, now they're turning on him. We all knew it was going to happen, but it's just amazing to me. They now they're all shocked. Oh, I can't believe he's the president. You helped him get in the presidency. You gave him as much access. You meaning the media, Jim. You understand what I'm saying?
I thank you very much.
But I'm always amazed by the media's couldn't wait to go live to him at a factory or a speech or wherever. And now all of a sudden he's our president. You're like, oh, we didn't see this coming. How did you not?
Well, Sean, you're right, I think, about the campaign, but I think you're wrong about the reporting. The reporting that is being done is exactly that. They are reporting on the activities and statements and those kinds of things of the president. They're not cooking this stuff up. You're not suggesting that. It is fair to say that
during the campaign, yeah.
They, as soon as he opened his mouth, it was 24/7 coverage of candidate Trump. You're
I remember
right.
One time, Sean, there was like an empty podium, and I presume it was on CNN because that's what I usually watch. There was an empty podium where Donald Trump was going to be speaking. I don't know, 10 minutes, 15 minutes. We kept looking at the empty podium with a split screen on something else. Although I would argue, though, Sean, that the campaign of Donald Trump promised different things than it turns out is happening. You know, I mean, he ran as a populist. He ran as a guy that was going to get out of wars. He was not running as a guy that was going to get into a nuclear war with North Korea or take away people's health care. He's going to give us better health care, and he was going to give us...
tax the rich, too.
Tax the rich. So... He did a total 180, and I think that's part of the reason. I know that's, I mean, I was never a fan of his, but that's part of the reason I'm upset with him is because of the policies and how he's turned around on the policies.
Sean, thanks for the call. Sean's right, though. I mean, the media obviously helped create or at least bolster the image and profile of candidate Trump without a shadow of a doubt.
Oh,
nobody
totally.
Got coverage.
And it was because
like that.
It was because he was so
great
telegenic
TV.
And he was great TV and he was great ratings and therefore great.
So, Marty,
money.
Have you decided, I mean, since we're discussing the serious yes. issues these days, is it wings or guacamole Sunday night? What have you, I mean, sort of like the Super Bowl, you're preparing. I have to say, my interest in this is waned in light of last night's interview with Karen McDougal. It's sort of like been there, done that, unless this DVD thing that we just read.
Pictures.
I mean, is
Pictures.
That even remotely
and also,
possible?
And also, it's going to be totally different because she is a porn actress, because she's got a very clever lawyer that she's working with. I think it's going to be a very different sort of scenario. But
why? Why do you say that?
Although, when was
I
this?
I think McDougal was a... She seemed like as you a totally credible,
she did.
Normal human being who happens to be a model and a former playmate.
Yeah, no, I mean, I you know, think that she was quite contrite over this whole situation.
By the way, the only thing I didn't understand is I had no idea why she was talking to Anderson Cooper or anybody else, since she said she was thrilled that they killed the story at AMI or whatever the initials are for the parent corporation of the National Enquirer. If you're happy that it was killed,
yeah.
But at the same time, what was the line she
wants
used
to
all last
claim
night?
Her own truth.
Claim her, get her...
Or something
right,
like that.
Truth,
something to
yes.
do with her own truth. She wants to have her own truth out there, her own story out there. But, I mean, you know, you think better of her, I think, after you saw her last night, don't you?
What do you mean better of her?
Well, because I think that you listened to her. She seemed like a person with some conscience, a person with some empathy, a person who realized she was doing a bad thing,
yeah.
And a person who really liked this
she
guy.
She seemed like a normal... Actually,
yeah, so
being,
it was a little bit, it wasn't like a Paula Kennedy Jones kind of situation
human.
With Bill Clinton where it was a 10-minute see you later kind of thing.
Well, actually, you know, it's funny. Because I'm a big fan of Jennifer Granholm's, as you know, the mm-hmm. former governor of Michigan.
Yep.
She was the first person to comment on the 9-hour interview last night with Anderson Cooper. And I'm paraphrasing, but this is not unfair to her. She says how a horrible thing. I can't believe Donald Trump. We've never seen anything like this before. And I'm waiting for the first other panelist to say, actually, we saw this, and I would argue worse under another candidate who you supported, Clinton.
I think the only place where Trump has got Clinton beat is that he had multiple women at one time.
Here she goes again. And what was he wearing, Marjorie?
His pajamas.
His pajamas.
Yeah, that's right. And he loved to watch Shark Week. I think that was another thing we read, which I find rather interesting. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. You know what's great about this? It's kind of a diversion because...
From
whether we're going to have a nuclear,
war
with North Korea. I would rather think about, Karen McDougal and Stormy Daniels and think about John Bolton and what's going to happen
next.
Well,
I would say John Bolton is probably not worried about Karen McDougal, and he probably is focusing on some sort of war.
Yes, he probably is. But I'd rather think about this for at least a little bit before we have to worry about war and disaster
and
terrible things happening.
We have time for one more quick one, Marjorie.
Okay, let's go to Jay in Compton, Rhode Island. Hi, Jay.
Good morning, both of you.
Hi.
Jim, I respectfully disagree with your premise that
sure.
this kind of behavior is not important nor something that's relevant. I think it is. When we live in society, all of us agree to a social contract that we will abide by laws and rules and certain mores of standard, of personal behavior, mm-hmm. when it is the leader of our country, whether it's a mayor or the leader of our country, it's even more important than we American citizens to abide by the rules, the laws, and those social standards. We won't cheat on our wives. We won't take your wife, your girlfriend away from you. We won't do these kinds of things if we're going to have a socially peaceful society. And I think that's the critical thing. What kind of people are we electing to govern this culture, this society that we live in?
I think you said it well, Jay. Yeah. I mean, I happen to think that the personal behavior is not our business unless it violates laws or puts them in potential spots to be blackmailed. But I think you make a very compelling case, as does Marjorie on the other side of that. And thank you for the call.
And mine, again, is like the disposability of women, that they're just there for the taking and use them and get rid of them. It's an attitude about women that, you know, they all had. I mean, whether it's talking about JFK, or whether you're talking about Bill Clinton, or whether you're talking about Donald Trump. And since I am a woman,
you are a woman,
I feel a little sensitive about that.
Well, I like to think
issue.
I'm sensitive to the issue, too, but yeah. I just have a different take on, I guess, public officials. But thanks for your calls, everybody.
Okay, we are still talking about this.
No, we're not.
We're moving on. That's right. I'm sorry. We are moving on. Coming up, we're going to talk to Jason Margolis from PRI's The World about globalism and cities and towns, how they're being affected by it across America. He joins us for another installment of 50 States, America's Place in a Shrinking World.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Attorney General joins us at 12:30. As a candidate and as president, Donald Trump has been consistent in his views on NAFTA.
For too long, our government has abandoned the American system. Since NAFTA was approved in 1994, the worst trade deal ever made by any country, I think, in the world, America has lost nearly one-third of its manufacturing jobs. Do not worry. We are starting on NAFTA very soon.
Well, that was Trump last year in Kentucky, but it's a message that also resonates in Connecticut among progressive Democrats. Jason Margolis has been reporting on why that is. He's a correspondent for PRI's The World. He went to Connecticut as part of a series, 50 States, America's Place in a Shrinking World, which looks at how communities are changing in this hyper-globalized world. He joins us for another installment from the series. Jason, it's great to see you. Welcome back.
Great to be back. Thank you.
Hey, thank you very much for coming in, Jason. Well, I was going to start with Arizona, but since Jim just talked with Connecticut, let's start with Connecticut. What is going on with the progressive Democrats in Connecticut?
Right. So the congresswoman down there in New Haven is Rosa DeLauro, and she's been in Congress since, I think, 1992 or 1990. So she was there when NAFTA was mm-hmm. passed, and she opposed it from the start. And she said she got into arguments with President Clinton about it. She disagreed with President Obama when he was trying to negotiate TPP, the trade deal between the Asia-Pacific nations. And she says Trump is the best opportunity that progressives have had in 25 years to renegotiate NAFTA. And when she says this, you can see her kind of wince. Like, she's not a Trump fan, but
right.
on this issue, Trump's her guy. So.
Why? Where's she coming from? What's the impact on her constituency or what she cares about?
So she says about 100,000 people in Connecticut have lost their jobs in manufacturing since NAFTA took effect. That is true. Now, can we blame it all on NAFTA? No. Lots of things have happened since 1994. We've joined the WTO, the World Trade Organization. I'm sorry, we've allowed China to join the WTO. Manufacturing, robotics have improved so much. So you can't really say all those jobs went to NAFTA. But she does say there was a BIC plant. They made razors. Now they're in Mexico. So that things like that did happen.
But you know what's amazing to me? I mean, Massachusetts was a big textile place, right?
Right?
Lawrence, Lowell, Fall River, where I grew up, everybody, you know, was rich on textiles.
Sure.
And those jobs all moved south. So that was long before NAFTA ever happened. Sometimes when I was reading about the congresswoman, it's like she's trying to go back to something that's never coming back. It's almost like the president with the coal miners. You know, I guess you, between robotics, those changes, and other industries that are going forward, like, you know, clean energy and solar and stuff like that, it just seems hard that they're hearkening back to ancient times.
I agree with you and I disagree with you. In her case, I think she's very smart. She understands you can't go back to 1960. You can't go back to 1970s. What she wants, she says she's not opposed to trade agreements. What she wants is fairer trade. So she wants to support the Mexican workers, for example, because Mexican workers are paid so poorly, there's no way a manufacturing plant in Connecticut can compete. So
right.
She says,
it's not a level playing field.
It's not a level
Clinton
playing field.
And Clinton resisted that,
yeah,
too, the fair
I get
labor
that,
standards.
But do you think we're going to be paying the Mexican workers what we're paying American workers?
That's the question, and nobody knows. Because do you know how these trade deals are negotiated?
No, I don't.
In secret.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like they're playing poker. Nobody knows what's going on. And Rosa DeLauro, who's a member of Congress and is a high-ranking member on trade issues, if she wants to know what's going on in one of these trade deals, she has to go in a basement room in the Capitol, and she can look at these documents. She cannot take notes, and she cannot talk about it. So,
wow.
So you and I...
Whose rule is that?
It's just the way they've always been done. And the reason behind that is that you don't want to show all your cards.
Yeah.
So if we say we're, you know, this is what our trade negotiator is negotiating, we don't want Canada to know this is what we're doing.
So let's continue our strange bedfellows on NAFTA discussion. To go from progressive Democrats who support Donald Trump on this, let's go to Arizona. Here's Greg Stanton, the Democratic mayor of Phoenix, on what would happen if Donald Trump destroyed NAFTA.
For us, it's like, here we go again. You know, we had worked so hard to overcome past political mistakes made here in Arizona, to overcome that, to build a stronger economic relationship with Mexico. And now, not at a local level, not at a state level, but at a federal level, we're facing immense threats to this improved relationship. Make no mistake, these are high-wage jobs that are associated with trade with Mexico. And if NAFTA were blown up in the way that the president has threatened to do so, that would really, really hurt us here locally.
So, Jason, so blue Connecticut is with Trump and red Arizona is against Trump. Why?
Exactly. So Stanton, the mayor of Phoenix, which is the nation's fifth largest city, he's a Democrat.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it is. I didn't know that either before
okay.
I went. So he's a Democrat, but Democrats and Republicans are opposed to ripping up NAFTA in Arizona. And let me just tell you through an example. There's a new company that's opening shop in Arizona about an hour south of Phoenix. It's called Lucid Motors. And it's a bunch of engineers from Tesla that said, hey, we can actually build a better car than Tesla. And they're opening in Arizona because they're going to build their car in Arizona, but it's going to have parts from Mexico, and they're going to build part of it in Mexico. It's going to go back and forth about 8 times. With NAFTA, you can do that. If NAFTA were eradicated, you can't do that. Or I mean, you could, but you'd have to pay a tariff probably all, you know, each way, and the car would be prohibitively expensive.
Mm-hmm. So, okay, so what's the solution then?
So everybody agrees, from the progressives to the conservatives, that NAFTA needs a revision, right? It was signed in 1994, so it's 24 years old. It needs some updating, intellectual property, agricultural rules. The disagreement is, what are you going to revise? And again, nobody knows what they're talking about because all the negotiations are in secret. The progressives say it's all about labor rights, it's about environmental issues, and then the conservatives want, you know, corporate interests to be maintained.
Well, and labor rights, but in all fairness, as a former union guy myself, it's not just concern for the workers there. It's when labor rights, standards, and conditions are as depressed as they are in Mexico, obviously there creates a competitive disadvantage
right.
that screws American workers who they're representing or would like to represent, obviously.
Sure.
So it's both selfish and selfless, I guess, is a fair way to put it.
I think that's fair, yeah. Yeah.
So can we go? We're going to end the show today with a quiz with a couple of craft beer guys.
Oh, great.
And it turns out you have a bit of a craft beer experience of late. And let's play some sound here. Here's the manager of export markets for Colorado's craft brewery. It's called New Belgium. Casey, how do you say his last name?
Colheed.
Okay,
it's
Colheed. Oh, excuse me. Oops. On the difficulties of exporting beer.
The fact is, it's expensive to ship a heavy liquid overseas, and logistically, tricky.
The biggest challenge is quality. You know, our beer tastes best, all beer tastes best fresh. So you've already got time against you going across the ocean.
And I should have set that up by saying the reason we even talk about how difficult it is, because apparently Europe has developed quite a taste, according to you, for American craft beer, American craft beer.
Right. And yeah, Sam Adams, local brewer here, won a big award in Munich.
Yeah, that was an Oktoberfest or whatever the hell that's called.
Yeah. And it was about 8 years ago, and all of a sudden Europeans were like, wait a second, what are these beers coming from the United States? And for whatever reason, Swedish bars have a lot of American beers, and a lot of American craft beers, and they were doing really, really well for several years, and then it kind of took a nosedive. I mean, we're still exporting there, but one of the main reasons is the dollar has gotten stronger. So a six-pack of beer, of Fat Tire beer, which is where I was in Colorado, would cost about $10 in Colorado, costs about $18 now in Stockholm because of the price of the dollar and the price of transporting it overseas.
So how do they transport it? I mean, that's the catch, is it not?
That's very interesting. So what they do is they'll either send over barrels, or there's a company in Brooklyn Brewing Company.
I've heard of them.
They ship them over in huge tanks. And the reason why...
In boats.
And they'll have tanks within the boats. And the reason why they do that is so they don't have to bring the kegs back over, because that costs money. So then they'll put them in barrels over there.
You were just down in Alabama.
Yes.
Doing trade stuff as well as just kind of filling up a lay of the land? What were you doing down there?
Oh, so Marjorie, so what I did was I was doing some stuff on cars and catfish, but I also spoke with the people there. I said, after the interviews were done, I said, hey, I'm going on this show, our local show. I'm not kidding. I was Jim and Marjorie, and I said, I've been listening to them, and they're very intrigued, very intellectually intrigued by what's going on with Stormy Daniels and whatnot.
That's right. So, we are intellectually intrigued,
yes.
Absolutely.
So I asked, it's a very conservative state, and I talked to some older white gentlemen who are very conservative. I said, what do you think of the president's behavior? And
are you serious about this?
I'm totally serious.
Oh,
yeah.
Great.
No,
go ahead.
I'm always working for you, Jim.
Thank you.
So so what they said, they like the policies, but not the man. And I talked to so many people, and when you bring up President Trump, on both sides, so we talk about that progressive congresswoman from Connecticut.
Rosa DeLauro.
Yeah, and I'm talking to all these conservatives down in Alabama, and when you ask about President Trump and either his tweets or his philandering, they all kind of go, ah, and they sigh. And so, to your point you were making earlier, I was talking to this conservative gentleman who was an older man, and he said, you know, I don't excuse it, but JFK did the same thing, and Bill Clinton said, I'm not saying it's right. I do feel there's hypocrisy among evangelicals, but we support his policies.
Which policies?
Less regulations, lower taxes.
Well, using the word hypocrisy, they're being hypocrites, because the implication is, well, an affair is just an affair. Mm-hmm. Well, how about the fact that a guy who is a credibly accused pedophile only lost the race for the U.S. Senate by 22,000 votes? That's not like having an extramarital affair. That's like committing serious, big-time felonious crime, and almost half of the people who voted in Alabama are ready to send him to Congress.
The white people.
Doesn't matter who it is.
Yeah,
he got lost by 22,000 votes.
And he was also, not only that, he was also a white supremacist. Right. I think it's fairly clear.
Well, I'm going to address both your points really quick. So I talked to some black people as well down there, and they just, see the people in their 50s, so they were born right after the civil rights movement in Alabama, which was really the epicenter of what was going on, and they feel they're just so upset and scared at what's happening. They have young children or, you know, teenagers.
What's happening with what?
With the mood of the country.
Uh-huh.
They feel it's just such a step backwards, and they were just despondent what President Trump has unleashed in this country. And to your point about Roy Moore, what Alabamians I met, I think it's Alabamians, is that sound
we
right?
We know who they are, okay. Whatever it is. Yeah.
What they were most upset about, some of them, was President Trump's treatment of Jeff Sessions.
Oh, their senator. Yeah, their homeboy.
That's their native son. Yeah. And I guess President Trump called him Mr. Magoo. He's called him that a few times.
Yeah.
And they find that deeply offensive because, you know, he's their guy. He's represented them in the Senate for decades. And that stings to them.
Yeah.
So they were really offended by that.
You know, get back to African-American voters for a second.
Sure.
I understand trepidation of all voters, but particularly people of color in this country. But I'm sort of surprised to hear you say this. I know it's anecdotal. It isn't like you did a survey. But I would assume that there'd be a sense of power. I mean, they just defeated a guy who virtually none of America thought could be defeated despite his transgressions. They elected a moderate Democrat to the United States Senate from the state of Alabama to over a hero, and again, despite his grotesque, credible behavior, there was no sense of, listen, if we can do this, we really have power to do even greater things beyond our borders?
I think they are feeling the issue very personally, and the issue, I mean, the mood of the country. So I was talking to this one gentleman who was in his 50s, and he was saying that his son has been called the N-word. And, you know, he said, I thought that had passed, you know, in school. And his son, he said his son punched the other kid, and he was kind of happy about it. But
well, Joe Biden's about to punch Donald Trump, yeah, there so there's no there reason his kid shouldn't punch the other kid.
But,
right?
I mean, when that happens, I can think everything else goes out the window. Maybe you feel good
totally
that you elected someone, but, you know, that's a big step backwards.
How much fun is this, by the way, going all over the country? I mean, Marjorie and I bitch because the only place we're allowed to go is like Somerville.
Right.
But I mean,
Somerville's nice.
Somerville's fat. We love Somerville. Yeah. But I'm serious. How much fun is this?
It is really fun. And it is an amazing opportunity. And I have to take a step back and say, what an incredible opportunity and job I have that I can talk to these mayors from these tiny towns in Alabama to Phoenix, Arizona, to Congress people, and they're willing to speak and speak openly.
That's right.
It's great fun.
That's the power of PRI.
It is the
National
power of
Public
PRI.
Radio.
No, but in all seriousness, well,
around.
A lot of think there's, you know, if you're not a left-wing nut, you don't like public radio. In so many of these places, public radio is essentially the lifeline, as you know, mm-hmm. far better than I, particularly in some rural communities around the state and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so. I would imagine the public radio station in Alabama is a little bit more conservative than the one in Boston.
I visited the one in Huntsville, Arizona. Yeah. It was great to see because it's a good reminder. It was like seven people working in there. They had CDs all over the place and like, you know, like, six small disheveled offices, and that's where the way public radio is in most parts of the country. It's not
like
WGBH at Boston Public Library.
Yeah, they don't have a place in the library with 40-foot glass windows.
No, they don't.
Jason, thank you very much.
Jason, good to see you again. Thank you.
Jason Margolis is a correspondent and reporter for PRI's The World. His ongoing series is 50 States, America's Place in a Shrinking World. You can catch PRI's The World weekdays at 3 p.m. and weeknights at 8 p.m. right here on 89.7 WGBH. Thank you again, Jason. Coming up, Emily Rooney is here for her Fulminations and Fixations. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library, and Emily is next on Boston Public Radio.
At noon on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, Emily Rooney's here with her famous list of fixations and fulminations, plus her take on this week's double feature. Last night's CNN interview with Trump's alleged mistress, Karen McDougal, and this Sunday 60 Minutes exclusive with Stormy Daniels. If Trump hates the press now, what will his tweets look like on Sunday night?
Attorney General Maura Healey joins us for an hour of Ask the Attorney General, taking our questions and yours. Then Callie Cross explains why Boston food trucks are stuck in the breakdown lane. And we top it all off with our Friday news quiz with the two local brewers and a preview of next month's Power Brew Fest. That and more is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It's Friday. We are broadcasting live from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Hello again, Jim.
Hi, and I shouldn't say this because it's sort of airing our dirty laundry. We almost had like a standoff here that was very unpleasant between you and me. Marjorie and I were deciding what our lunch was going to be from the Newsfeed Cafe. And neither of us was willing to go get it. It was
tense for a minute, wasn't it? That's right. Neither of us is willing to go get
it. That was really
unpleasant. I spend more time getting it than he spends getting it.
I would argue, stay out of this, Emily.
I put my headsets on.
Thank you very much. Speaking of Emily, joining us for open mic and her famous list of fixations, fulminations, and more is the great Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press.
Hey, Margie,
Emily.
Jim.
Hello. Good to see you.
So it's a good thing on Friday.
So it's really pathetic, but this is how my weekend is lining up. I'm all excited about Karen McDougal was last night, and can't wait till Sunday night when I back and see Stormy Daniels, the porn actress, on 60 Minutes. What would Mike Wallace
Of course, that was recorded more than 10 days ago already.
It was recorded more than 10 days ago, because I'm thinking, how does she top this?
She can't.
Well, there
right,
is
so here's what I was fixating on last night. Mm-hmm. Well, and like you,
watch all things.
I was riveted, and I thought she was credible, and everything else you've already said. But I was fixating on the fact that Anderson Cooper knows what Stormy Daniels said. He can't say it because he has a conflict of interest. He works for CBS News, and clearly he can't say he couldn't refute a single thing that Karen McDougal said, although he might have known a lot more about the timeline, you know, because Karen McDougal said she was having an affair the exact same week.
At Lake Tahoe.
At Lake Tahoe that Stormy Daniels
says. That is a wonderful point.
He might know. And meanwhile, he can't ask Stormy Daniels about what Karen McDougal said because it's already on TV.
So what does he do with that in light of the fact that he got both interviews, obviously, and they were hot ones to get? What does he do? I mean, maybe he should have said something about that.
He should have said something.
Yeah.
And the other thing that bugged me all last night was, it's very minor, but it said on the screen that the interview was live. That was not a live interview. He taped that. He played it as if live. That's that's a TV thing that we all know about.
Mm-hmm.
As if live. But it wasn't live.
It wasn't live. No.
Well, I want to take another angle here.
I just want to point out that we can't leave out the two other women who were also there that same Lake Tahoe weekend. We're talking about four women one weekend.
Yes.
At least that was according to the New Yorker.
Well, it was a whole week. Karen said she was his date for the week.
Right.
And then she said, as I'm sure you heard, that I can't imagine when he had time for Stormy Daniels, although he did mention that there were some porn stars there, unless he started the relationship with her the day I left.
Exactly. Well, in any case,
possible.
I was thinking of you last night when I was texting Marjorie.
Very impressive.
Because Anderson Cooper asked some stuff that even he didn't want to ask.
Yeah.
It's pretty clear. And you can say either a producer said you had to do it or he decided to whatever. Here he is asking her about whether or not Citizen Trump a decade ago used protection. Here it is.
Did he ever use protection?
No, I didn't.
Was that something you thought about, or it didn't concern you at the time?
You know, we talked about it right beforehand. He was starting to, and then he's like, I don't like these things, and, you know, we discussed things, do you, blah, 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 and we were just honest with each other, and we didn't use any.
You know, I'm sorry.
I thought it was fair game.
Why is it, you know, again, I love him, but why is that
because
fair game?
Because to me, it speaks to, talk about Me Too and arrogance and, you know, that this guy is so entitled that he wouldn't think that that was something that he had to do. He understands the principle of it, which is why he brought a condom with him, but this is Donald Trump, and he's not going to bother with that because he doesn't like
so
it.
So you don't think any of the questions were
nope.
beyond the
nope.
pale?
Nope. I would ask the same one.
Okay.
Well, how come, by the way, the one question he didn't ask, since we're getting down and dirty, is after she mentioned that he offered to pay her after the first
did she take the money?
Well, she said she didn't, but he never said the obvious thing is, how much was it?
Yeah. That's
weren't you dying to find that one out?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah, $100, $1,000, $5,000.
I would say
bucks.
It was not $100.
Maybe didn't
but, you know,
go that
if
far.
He's asking, so you thought the protection question was okay from a
I did.
From an arrogance perspective or a
I did.
STD perspective?
It just speaks to more about his character and his sense of entitlement, I thought, and whether he was concerned about an STD or getting her pregnant, which was possible 10 years ago.
Maybe she should have asked him more questions about what they did. What
well,
do you
they
think?
Might. He could have done that too. I would have
no,
been,
but
I
been wait. It's game. Pretty clear to me that would, there was an arrangement about that because remember one of her final comments was when he was trying to say why are you doing this and it never quite was clear to me why she did.
Oh,
do
I
it.
Thought it was clear.
What is her reason?
Well, she felt like she was really betrayed, and she admitted she was naive and maybe even dumb during that whole time that
the negotiations with the inquirers.
AMI, what is it called? AMI, the Inquirer, AMI. And she felt duped, and she wanted to take back control of her own story because she thought she had given it to them for money, of course, and then she was going to get some side gig on the. But she realized she was duped. Because
but she said
just,
she was happy it was killed. If she said she was happy it was killed, then why is she now outing herself?
I don't think she realized why it was killed. She didn't realize there was a quid pro quo, and that's why she said she wanted to take back the quid pro quo being that they were friends with that the owner of The Inquirer is friends with Donald Trump, and they bought the story.
Okay, I'm taking one last shot at this, and then I'm going to give up. As a woman who obviously was the first woman in America to be the executive producer of a national newscast, you know better than virtually anybody. Explain to me why this interview, other than ratings, and I know that's a ridiculous thing to say, why shouldn't this have been 15 minutes instead of whatever it was, 75 minutes?
Well, that's sheerly based on ratings, because they knew that it would carry, and that's why they went over the hour. They kept
Break at 9 o'clock.
They didn't even break at 9 o'clock because they knew she was going to. We're all talking about it. Everybody, and I also have to say, and this is something they knew, which is why the live thing bothered me. They knew they had a really good interview. And just say what it is. We're going to go over time here. We got a lot of material here, but they were pretending it was live. It wasn't live, as if that was the reason why they kept going.
So why didn't
they knew they had a really good interview? If the interview had stunk, they wouldn't have played as much of it.
Well, again, I not only respect his work, but I think he's a pretty ethical character. Why didn't he just say what you suggested? Why didn't he just say, by the way, I should tell the audience?
I have a conflict of interest. Yes. I work for CBS News. I can't reveal the details of an interview I conducted 10 days. He should have.
CNN
should have insisted, because they're the ones really holding the short end of this. Yes.
I agree.
Okay, one last thing about this for me. Well, actually, two last quick things. I thought she was totally credible.
Yes.
Okay. And the other thing is, does it even matter? I mean, I think his base probably, if they watched it last night, thought, wow, he had an affair with a Playboy bunny, this is swell. And now he had an affair with a porn star.
No, it doesn't matter, but it matters for what I think Jim raised earlier, and we've talked about too, about whether the money was an in-kind contribution,
illegal campaign contribution
to
right.
the campaign, and that's really, but you know, just in terms of it being, for one thing, he has denied all of this. If he had admitted it, it wouldn't be that big a deal. But he's lying.
Yeah. Are you going to the viewing party at Marjorie's Sunday?
What do you need me to bring?
That's right, guacamole, please. Okay. That's the one thing I'm missing.
We're talking about Emily Rooney.
You know what?
Oh, we can't keep talking about this.
All right, we're done. Okay.
Okay, is that okay?
One more thing.
I was just going to say he should admit it, because people would love it.
Yeah.
Gun march. What are you doing on the gun march? Are you doing something on television about the gun march?
No, but I have to say, I have been really impressed with the spokespeople.
So have
I. Oh, my God.
I was listening to a riveting interview on NPR this morning that wasn't David.
It was Cameron. His name?
Different
his last
kid.
Name begins with a K.
Yeah. 17 years old.
He was amazing.
He could have been 57.
His
really level
good.
Of understanding, and the reporter kept pushing back on him, and he was so articulate, and it was just very impressive.
You know what,
we're broadcasting here live tomorrow from 1 to 3.
March is at noon.
It starts at noon, and we'll be here from 1 to 3 broadcasting. Everybody wants to come down to the library tomorrow, and the march is going to start up at the high school.
Madison Park,
and come down to the
common.
But Marjorie and I didn't know this till this morning. Maybe you did, Marjorie, again, from that same NPR. Oh, actually, it was from Cameron, whatever his name is. He said on the air, no one older than 20 is going to speak.
Yes.
Actually, it's older than 18. So I don't know if the exception to that is elected officials. Marjorie and I both hope there are no elected officials.
I hope you're right.
That it is all kids. But how great is that? Yeah. If that's really the rule of the day, and there's a diverse, and by the way, these kids from Parkland have gone out of their way at Harvard and elsewhere to say you got to worry about kids of color, like they traveled to Chicago to meet kids who had lived amongst gang violence.
That's what was so great about that. Yeah. Cameron, he says, I realize I grew up in a privileged
white
community.
Privilege,
I brought up this last week for the Globe, actually, that there's so many kids here killed in Boston, and we're small potatoes compared to places like Chicago and Philadelphia, which have these horrible homicide rates. But, you know, in the gun thing, unfortunately, it's a totally different thing, because they're talking about assault weapons, and most of the inner-city killings are
it's not assault
weapons. They're with handguns.
And they're much more personal. They're gang violence. Mm-hmm. Even if they don't know the other person, they know he's a member of a rival gang.
Or they're very often just the wrong
person.
They hit the wrong person because they're lousy shots or it's some retaliation thing. Totally innocent young men. It's usually young men. Sometimes young women as well.
I'm so glad to hear you say what you said about these kids, because I felt the exact same way. The thing that I was dead wrong about, horrible choice of words here, I thought it's Cameron Caskey. Thank you to one of our colleagues who typed his last name up. I thought there wouldn't be staying power, particularly after losses.
It's only been three weeks.
No, but still, look at adults. Most of us have an attention span of a gnat.
Yeah.
And as soon as, you know, a mass killing happens and a week later we're off on Stormy Daniels or something else, they didn't get all they wanted, even though they got some decent things in Florida. That didn't deter them. I know from having listened to these people, they know that Congress is not going to do anything more. We discussed this with Chuck Todd, and they've probably already done. But they've even embraced incrementalism, which is such a grown-up thing.
Yes.
Because when I was, I wanted everything, and I wanted it that minute. And they have accepted with the, I interviewed a 14-year-old high school, or 15, from Somerville High the other day on Greater Boston, who was talking about the importance of incrementalism. You make modest.
That's great.
And I'm saying, what?
How do they even know what it means?
How do they even know what it means?
I know. And even that mantra about, how does it go? Thoughts and prayers. We don't want your.
Yeah.
We don't want your. That's a great one.
Yeah.
Because that's the first thing that most adults do. You have our thoughts and prayers. And they go, you know what? Keep it to yourself.
I know. And I think that's going to, I hope, embarrass some people in Congress who say that stupid thing over and over again, which is so disingenuous anyway.
By the way, I hope they're doing the same thing here down the block. I hope if the rule of the day is 18 or under,
that's right.
I hope the rule obtains in downtown Boston.
We won't be allowed in, Jim. We can just wave.
No, I'm serious. And by the way, say it again. 1 to 3, we're broadcasting. Yep. Join us in the library. Call in. And we will have a guest as well. We're talking to Emily Rooney, host of Beat the Press. So is it true you have some inside poop on the Yawkey Way deal?
No, not really. I've just been doing I'm doing a piece on it tonight, and I've been doing some research and reporting and phone calling.
Can you give 30 seconds of background for the three people who don't know what's
going
on? So
for years, there's been this movement afoot to change the name of Yawkey Way. Now they're talking about moving it back to its original name, which is Jersey Street. As you all know, owner of the Boston Red Sox, John Henry, is on board for it. They filed a petition with the Boston City Council.
Yeah, yeah,
one of the leaders, because a number of people have been calling for it.
Yeah.
So I'm just not convinced that this is going to happen. They did have a hearing last week, and it was sort of the first time that in a public forum it was kind of equal footing, because for the most part we've only heard the reasons why to change it. And I have to say, as somebody, I don't know Tom Yawkey. I mean, I never knew Tom Yawkey. I, of course, know who he was. And I believe his foundation gave WGBH $7 million to build that
Yawkey Theater.
And I know that the foundation does really good work, because I've known a lot of people who work with it. I've had this uneasy feeling about what the facts are. I mean, did he go around using the N-word? I know the team was the last to integrate, but if you listen to some of the reasoning behind that, I just don't know if there's enough there. And maybe some people have it. Maybe there is enough. I haven't seen it, other than they were the last team to integrate.
You know what I thought was a pretty interesting fact, which I did not know? Jack Sullivan reported in Commonwealth Magazine how back when they tried to integrate the schools in South Carolina, that he gave millions and millions of dollars for one of these so-called segregated white academies.
Who did?
Yawkey.
A million total over the years.
What that did was basically prevent black kids from getting an education, and that was pretty dastardly, I thought. I mean, that's what Jeff Sessions got in trouble for in Alabama, which is not South Carolina. He was in Alabama, and Yawkey was in South Carolina.
Do you think what you think? Why do you think that Henry, who doesn't go out on the...
He hasn't shown up himself. He's only had his attorneys make the arguments for him.
No, but he's taken a really bold position.
I know, yes.
Used
I know.
Words like we want Fenway to be
it's
seen
haunting.
As an inclusive
I understand. Yes,
place.
I know.
He's used really powerful language.
He didn't show up himself, which I think was a mistake, because I think the commissioners there wanted to interview him about this. What was the reason? He had all this legal speak about it. And also talk about things that were recent. The Lowell Sun had this piece about how Jersey has this long history of slave involvement himself. So the guy whose name the street was originally, so I don't know.
Oh, I thought it wasn't a person. I thought it was something
else.
Some
guy
told us
it was
H.I.J.
There's some connection with slavery there. So
it wasn't Gloucester, Hereford, Ipswich, and Jersey.
Oh, that was a caller to our show.
Yeah.
Well, it was, but Jersey may not have been a place.
You have to look that up.
This
is a Peter Lucas
but
piece.
But so wait a second. Is the goal to have this resolved? Well, first of all, there's a commission hearing
The 30th, and the opening day here is the 5th, am I right?
I don't know what day it is. So in the next week or so.
I think they were hoping to have it done before that, at least a decision made.
Well, the only thing to add to your story, which I was also not aware of until I read either Jack Sullivan's piece or a piece in the newspaper yesterday, was that people like Jack Connors, who don't want to change, a pretty powerful character in town, and a few others, are suggesting the Yawkey Foundation and Henry, on behalf of the Red Sox, donate, what, $10 million each to
foster
racial harmony. But see, my response to that is, I don't understand why you can't do both things.
Because
why can't you honor the Yawkey Foundation's generosity and change the name of the street?
You're going to taint the Yawkey Foundation's generosity. I mean, I think GBH would feel uncomfortable keeping the Yawkey Theater once the street sign has been removed.
You don't think it's tainted already by just the debate? You think if they don't change the name of the street, all of it goes away? I don't think it does at all.
Well, if they determine they're not going to change
it.
I don't know. It's like the Redskins.
You going to opening day? You're going to opening day.
I might.
In other words, yes. Marjorie and I have never gone to opening day, never been invited to opening day.
I know. It's really a tragedy. It's American tragedy.
Well, we think it is a tragedy. Okay. Emily, you are here for the following reason. Take it away.
Incomprehensible.
It's out of control.
How about common sense?
Doesn't matter.
Why not?
This is the kind of thing that drives people crazy.
It's your right.
Doesn't matter. I have absolutely no interest.
Exactly. Do you want to ask her the question, Marjorie, or should I?
Is your list thematic, Emily?
And participatory.
It's kind of an on theme.
Oh.
Oh, but that's all right, right?
What does
that
mean?
Absolutely. It's an on theme, and you guys can always you're gonna like some of these.
Okay. What's the theme?
The theme is things that just really fascinated me this week beyond things like Karen McDougal.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
A couple of them are related, too. And I think you guys know this about me, but I always have these fantasies about, you know, world geoengineering, how we can change things or make things better, move water from one part of the world to the next. Anyway, so I was fascinated about the Nepalese government, is that how you say it? Removing 200,000 pounds of trash off of Mount Everest.
I didn't know.
And how they're doing this.
200,000?
200,000 pounds. So they have to get Sherpas up there, first of all, these big nets and garbage bags, haul it down, and then they get these animals to bring it to the... They said that the pile of trash is almost as big as the mountain itself. 200,000 pounds.
So what kind of stuff is it? Is it the clothing or
Tubor beer. They were very specific. Mostly oxygen canisters. And you're supposed to bring everything off. Carry in, carry out.
You're not doing it.
Everybody... Bodies, Tubor, everything.
They're taking down bodies?
Well, they've been trying to remove bodies in recent years, yeah.
Tuborg beer?
Tuborg beer.
So they're like at base camp and having a couple of...
Yeah.
Wouldn't Tuborg. You?
I guess so.
You know, I don't want to preempt anything because that's a great start. Are you going to touch at some point on the thing in the ocean?
That's my next one.
Oh good.
This is even more unbelievable.
No, I mean, I get... And then I start thinking about how I would get rid of it. You know.
Go ahead. Tell people.
So this is the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. 87,000 tons, okay, of floating plastic in the Pacific. And the reason this is back in the news is because these scientists went up with, drones and airplanes, and they measured the mass of it. And more importantly, they dipped scoops in there and figured out exactly what it was because they thought it was all mashed pieces of plastic. It's not. It's real items. It's toys. It's mostly plastic toys. You know, that could have come in part from the tsunami, you know, years ago.
Yeah.
But that's mostly what it is. And, you know, so they said it's really... So wait a second. It's 87,000 tons of floating plastic, four times the size of California, and comprised of 1.8 trillion pieces of garbage. So they said they can create these eddies, these kind of, you know, man-made eddies, and siphon it out of this thing, and then hook up these big nets and draw it to the shore, and then have people haul it away to. But
and then put it on Mount Everest. That's what they do with it. Exactly.
Yeah.
That is,
wow.
Now that one is the one that totally blew me away.
I can't get enough of it.
Four times as big as California. Three times as big as France.
Wait a minute. I misunderstood or I didn't hear. Are they doing it now, or they're thinking
they're
of
starting?
Doing this?
They're trying to. They're doing it now. They're starting it. They've got these engineers involved in how to actually do this.
Well, that's pretty exciting, isn't it?
Yeah. So let me
I
ask
like
a stupid
this, Emily.
Question.
This is very good.
I read it in the Washington Post, and they didn't address the obvious question, at least for me. So when you're out on the water in a ship, you can't go through this, can you? So you have to... Oh, jeez.
Yeah, you got to know where it is. Yeah, no, you can't go
through
it.
You know, that plastic stuck
in. And it's also a lot of netting, and all these sea turtles are munching on it. It's terrible, I know.
How about those penguins? Let's not even talk about the penguins. Go ahead, Nancy.
Okay, another thing that it really just drew me in this week. I was listening to two young women on the PBS NewsHour, talk about being kidnapped by Boko Haram.
Oh,
I don't know if you
God.
Saw this interview by Judy Woodward. Oh my gosh! I mean, this is the first. They were kidnapped in the first sweep, so 4 or 5 years ago. So they're a little bit older now. They were 14 and 15 when it happened. So I think they're 19 and 20. Both of them got pregnant. Both of them had these unbelievable stories about both of their children died under different circumstances. But they were not only beautiful and sophisticated and willing to tell their stories, but they were very positive about their own futures. Although they said that they've been very lucky, they've had a lot of assistance from an American organization that, you know, helped them out with schooling and other things, but they're very worried about their you know, other children, mostly girls, in Nigeria, who their parents will take them out of school, because I didn't realize this, that Boko Haram means no Western education. Mm-hmm. That's what it means. So, and when they dropped off that batch of kids this week, that was what they said, don't put your kids back in school.
One last thing, since you mentioned Judy Woodruff, she was just named yesterday as the sole host anchor of PBS NewsHour. I love her. She is what?
I thought she already was after Gwen Ifill died.
Yeah, it was like a year and a half ago, but she is great. So in any case, next.
All right, we're going to talk about this on Beat the Press, and this is a little bit controversial because I have one position on it, and then Adam and some other people have another. Mm-hmm. Whether it's appropriate to bring up once again, and this time in that documentary about Aaron Hernandez, his sexuality. So both the lawyer and one of his ex-girlfriends mm-hmm. claims that they knew all along that he was gay. My argument is, which is why I'm very interested and fascinated by this, is because it's a potential reason, a motivation for murdering Odin Lloyd in the first place, which was never established. There was no motivation was ever established. If Odin Lloyd knew about these relationships, was that a reason? They don't make that conclusion in the documentary, by the way, but to me, that's what makes it fair game, not that it's just sort of this prurient curiosity about his sexuality.
Yeah,
I'm with you. I haven't seen it, but from what I've told, even though the thing supposedly is quite slanted in the direction of Hernandez, isn't it produced by Baez, one of the lawyers? I think it's one of the producers.
It's kind of anti-media too.
It seems to me that's a pretty relevant.
By the way,
the first person we should say in credit to
a former colleague of ours,
Michelle McPhee, is the first person.
Yeah, they don't go easy on her in the film though, because mm-hmm. they were making fun while she was on wide receiver, and it was all this kind of sexual innuendo.
No, I think that's legitimate criticism, too, but she is the first one who mentioned this issue.
Where can people see this documentary? What's it called?
Oxygen Network.
I think you have to have a subscription to some cable. I don't know.
Whatever.
Anyway.
Whatever. Next.
I saw it, you know.
Was it good?
Oh.
Was it good?
So I should have put this in with one of my top ones.
Emily, is it worth seeing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. The death of the last remaining northern white rhinoceros. Did you see that?
We talked about this yesterday briefly.
Oh, my God. It's so heartbreaking.
Male.
And so now they're going to try to crossbreed, and this is another science engineering thing that I love, some of his DNA with southern white rhinos, female southern. But, so it won't really be a pure breed, but I guess they're going to kind of reestablish. And this is something that is totally man-made. You know, poachers and people who think that the rhinoceros horn has some kind of sexual powers or something like this, that's reasonable.
There were 2,000 of them just a couple of years ago. And now, once Sudan, I think was
Sudan.
The male's name, died,
that was zero.
A daughter and a granddaughter,
two females,
who cannot get pregnant, apparently. No.
So they're going to try to geoengineer that.
I had the same reaction. That was a horrible story. And again, human caused.
I know this is kind of cheesy, but I was also really fascinated about the interview with Hope, not an interview, story about Hope Hicks in New York Magazine. And the thing that interested me most was this organization called Probe Media. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I stopped reading after 4 pages. It was so long. It was ridiculous.
No, but I was very interested in that. That was the only thing that really jumped out at me.
What is it?
Well, tell us.
Probe Media is this really slick, secret society, essentially, that you could hire, any one of us could hire, to essentially tail somebody. And they do it for, I'm sure, things like the National Enquirer. They won't reveal their client list. They won't see who's paying them. But she was tailed by this organization for the entire time she was in the White House.
Paid for by whom?
They don't say. Probe Media did the work.
Well, wait a minute.
Wow.
How is that different than a private detective?
Well, because a media outlet is paying for it.
Oh, a media outlet is paying for it. Oh, my goodness.
So that they can get pictures that they can put in their newspapers or whatever to make money. Yeah.
Did she know this was happening?
Yes. Yeah.
Wow.
And that's how they got, remember that picture of her in the back seat of the cab?
Yeah.
With, you know,
yeah.
That's where it came from.
Wow. Well, places like the National Enquirer pay their sources all the time. Do we presume it's National Enquirer?
They won't say who they are. And if you go on their website, it's really, you've got to sign up and ask them to contact you. And it's pretty creepy.
Let's hope it's not a legitimate news organization.
All right. It was also fascinating this week. I never watched Sex and the City.
Oh, yeah. It was good. My kids watched
Cynthia
it all
Cynthia Nixon running for governor. Yeah. And I'll tell you what really interests me about this. Nobody in New York State, unlike what happened here when Ayanna Pressley said she might run for, you know, the 8th Congressional, I think it is.
It's not 8th anymore, but
no, yeah, whatever
7th,
it is. 7th
or something.
So
yeah.
People like Barney Frank came out and said, oh, it's not her turn. No one is saying that to Cynthia Nixon. It's, you know, she's a Democrat. Cuomo's a Democrat. They're saying, hey, you know. It's almost like
Frank Bruni wrote a piece this morning.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Basically saying
it's not her turn.
No, saying that she has absolutely no
experience.
And why have we not learned in the wake of Trump that experience matters? And
apparently, it doesn't.
So what? Well,
it doesn't matter to most people.
But he makes a pretty compelling case. I shouldn't say compelling.
What about
he's
Hulk?
Strong.
What about who was the wrestler?
He was governor of Minnesota.
Yeah.
What is his name?
It didn't go well.
Jesse Ventura, right, exactly.
Or Arnold Schwarzenegger.
No, listen, I'm not advocating. I'm just saying Frank Bruni, a liberal columnist for the New York Times.
It's a woman, that's
basically
why.
Trashes it. But you know what also, you know what's worse about this? What's the name of the former head of the city council? Is her name Quinn, who's often on CNN?
Quinn.
She refers to her as, quote, an unqualified lesbian. And then she, by the way, she's a lesbian herself, and then she apologizes as well
that's
she
disgusting.
Should. What is the relevance of her sexual orientation to your criticism? It's fine to say she's unqualified. I thought that, and by the way, Bruni criticizes her for that too. What
All
else?
All right, finally.
Finally.
I was fascinated and a bit obsessed this week by an interview you guys had.
With whom?
With Harvard Business School professor Michael Norden.
Oh, yeah.
Who did this intensive research.
I love Michael.
I heard you reference it again today on negative behavior reinforcement. You know, if the guy in front of you is getting a slice of apple pie, you're more likely to do it, even though you said you weren't going to have
lowest
it.
Lowest common denominator.
The lowest common. I mean, so much of it made. I'd never heard anything like that put in. And it went long. I thought, oh, my gosh, I could have even heard more.
No, we love him because it so perfectly captures the oddities of human behavior.
Yes.
We're huge fans.
Well, it captured you, Jim. How you needed someone to buy
Jim
the apple pie.
Jim kept saying.
Before. I'm eating the
this
other
is
half
me.
Of
this
her
is
chicken
me.
Salad sandwich, Emily's. What are you doing tonight on Beat the Press,
All right,
Emily
so
Rudy?
We are going to be doing, this is a little bit, this one's kind of dicey. So the whole thing about the bomber in Austin, you know, some people wanted to call him a terrorist. A lot of people say he was a terrorist. And then there's all this coverage that was kind of soft. He was nerdy. He had a dry wit. And whether it had been an African-American or a Muslim or any person of color, would those kinds of soft descriptives ever made them way into
not.
The headlines? And another fascinating part of this, which I'm focused on, is the American media did mention that he was homeschooled, but the British media went much further and said, no, he wasn't homeschooled. He was part of a group of families that were really sort of like survivalist Christians, and that there was this kind of kooky mentality that they indoctrinated these kids with. So that's something we haven't really dug into. So there's a number of layers about it. I mean, how soft the coverage was. And then the police chief himself came out and said the kid was challenged instead of saying, you know.
I got it.
So we got that. We are going to do the Anyaki way, and we're going to look at whether the sexuality about Aaron Hernandez is
great.
Appropriate for media.
Good watching. Emily Rooney, we love you.
All
thanks
right.
so much
See
for
you
your
later.
Time. See you soon.
Emily Rooney, thank you very, very much.
7 o'clock tonight.
7 o'clock tonight on WGBH Beat the Press. Emily Rooney, thank you again. She joins us every week, of course, for Open Mic. Coming up, the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Maura Healey, is here to take our questions and yours. The Attorney General is next. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH. It is Friday. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. We're joined by Attorney General Maura Healey. The Attorney General is here for Ask the Attorney General. That's obvious, Jim. Taking our questions and yours, you can tweet her at BOS Public Radio, send her an email at bprwgbh.org, call her at 877-301-8970, or if you're at the library, you go over to Jason. Jason, raise your hand, please. Thank you very much. That's our coworker. Go over to Jason and say you'd like to ask a question of the Attorney General, and we will recognize you. Hello, Maura Healey. How are you?
I'm great.
Hello, Attorney General.
Nice
Thank
to
you
be
very
with
much
you.
For coming in. So I understand you are going down to Washington, D.C. for the March for Our Lives with some Sandy Hook parents.
Yeah, I was invited to march with the Sandy Hook family, some of whom I've come to know over the last few years. I will certainly be here in solidarity with the people of Massachusetts. There are going to be marches, I know, all across the state. I have a lot of folks in the Attorney General's office who want to be part of that and will be out tomorrow. But I'm going to be in D.C., and I'm really inspired and excited about tomorrow and this moment right now. Having spent a lot of time with families from Sandy Hook, with survivors of gun violence here in Massachusetts and in Boston, with families that I came to know through Pulse in Orlando, and so many more. It's just such, I think, an important moment and an important time. And
didn't you meet with Parkland kids? I heard
I did.
Harvard,
you know, I actually met with Parkland students privately in D.C. a few weeks ago.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
okay.
I was down there for some meetings, and I had heard that some were over at the Capitol in an effort to talk to different members of Congress. And so we reached out to Ted Deutsch's office, the congressman from Parkland, and I was able to go over, along with Greg Gibson, who lost his son to a school shooting here in Western Massachusetts 25 years ago. Mm. And so Greg and I went over and visited with four or five of those students privately. It was an incredibly touching moment for me to witness the conversation that Greg, this father, longtime advocate, was having with these young people. And Greg, as with Mark Barden, who I wrote an op-ed piece with today, he's a father of a little boy who was killed at Sandy Hook. You know, you listen to Greg, and he and I talked about how this fight has been going on for so long, but it was in listening to these Parkland students and engaging with them, he broke down, and he felt like this is a time and this is a moment where he feels something is different. And for me to be there and bear witness to that, it was a really incredible conversation. Those students, some of them came up the other night. They were here in Boston and Cambridge for a couple of days, so I went over and spent time with them, and they were great. It was great. I got some time to just talk to them a little bit about what we've been doing here, but mostly to listen, too. And, you know, I just am struck by their clarity of voice, their resilience, their resolve. All of them, to a person, you know, are such wonderful advocates. And I think that's why they are resonating. Remember, this is a generation that has only known mass shootings. Many of them were born just shortly at or around Columbine. And so they've lived their entire lives with this theory, this it's not a theory, unfortunately, but this the specter of mass shootings. And it was only a year ago or more that they saw what happened in Orlando, not too far from them, and then saw nothing happen. They saw what happened in Sandy Hook and saw nothing happen. And so, boy, these young people are just so inspiring, and I'm really looking forward to tomorrow.
Can I add one more thing to your list? We said this before we came. It's not just mass shootings. As you know, these six core players who were at the Iowa Institute of Politics went to Chicago the other day because they're concerned about inner-city violence, which is generally not mass shootings but constant shootings, and you know it much better than I. And their desire to diversify this thing in not only tomorrow but beyond is another, you know, just – incredible tribute to their sophistication and wisdom, I think.
And that's as it should be. I mean, this the fact of the matter is that so many Americans are killed every day or injured at the hand of a gun. And gun violence is something that occurs in our homes, in our communities, in our streets, in rural, urban, and suburban communities. Unfortunately, I agree with you that the plight, particularly of the reality of some living with gun violence as a constant thing in their neighborhood, is something that hasn't received the attention that it should. And it's wonderful that that these people, these young people from Parkland, are working together with kids and groups and organizations from all over to really, you know, do what needs to be done, which is let's not make this a discussion about Congress and Republicans and the NRA and the Second Amendment. Let's focus on what really is happening here and the reality that parents and young people have to wake up every day and wonder what's going to happen when their kid walks down the street to the bus stop, goes to the movies, hangs out at the mall, goes to school. And this is a reality that should be absolutely unacceptable to all Americans, regardless of party. And we know there are some common sense things that can be done that the vast majority of Americans are behind. And the good news is more and more people are waking up to this and will be holding people accountable this fall at the ballot box, as they should. It's also a great sign, in my view, that you see corporations stepping forward and saying, we're not going to sell guns anymore, or we're going to impose certain restrictions on that, like you saw with Walmart and Dick's Sporting Goods. But also look at Citibank and others stepping forward to say, you know what, we're not going to invest in the gun lobby's efforts any further, or things that will only enable the gun lobby to continue to do what they want to do, which seems to be to sell as many guns as possible without any regard to the price that we pay as a society. So I am really fired up and heartened by this movement and by these young people. It was fun to be with Emma Gonzalez, for example, the other night, and just talk with her about how she's handling
she
so much. They all are. I mean, they all, to a person, they all bring a little bit of a different perspective to this. And the one thing that I thought was really terrific, too, I was, you know, my dad's a teacher, my mom's a school nurse, and the one thing they remarked about was what they had learned from their teachers in school and the importance and the value of public education, because they had learned in their classes, they had learned about government, they had learned about civics, they'd had debate, they learned, you know, the importance of framing issues and how to speak, and had been given confidence and courage and help by their teachers over many years. And I just want to give a shout out to teachers everywhere for the work that they are doing. Teachers don't need to be armed with guns, that is for sure. They should be armed with resources and assistance and help, and our schools should be, particularly our public schools, should be funded and supported. Let's make sure, too, that we're supporting them with the kind of counseling and services that more and more kids really would benefit from when it comes to identifying mental health and behavioral health issues. But it was a really heartening week to be with these students and to hear where they're coming from on this. And I think that people here should be really, really encouraged and continue to speak out and continue to demand accountability from their politicians.
We're talking to Attorney General Maura Healey. She's with us for the hour. Before we get to the phone calls, I just want to ask you, kind of after that rousing discussion about this gun march and these kids, you've been very unpopular with certain segments of the gun lobby here in Massachusetts over this so-called copycat weapons. And a federal judge has said that the gun shops who are challenging you are able now to move forward with this court case against you. So explain to people what this is about and why you do not want these copycat guns made.
Well, you know, Massachusetts has had strong gun laws on the books. That's a good thing. Strong gun laws save lives. It is why Massachusetts has the lowest gun death rates in the country. Unfortunately, the gun lobby has challenged my efforts at every turn when it's come to enforcing those laws. I've enforced laws, for example, that require local police chiefs to be the ones to make the determination as to whether somebody's suitable or not to get a permit. NRA and the gun lobby challenged that. We were successful. We've been challenged on a lot of other laws, including recently my enforcement of our state assault weapons ban. So I've been sued not once but twice by the gun lobby on that. We continue to defend that law in court. And the good news is that since we enforced that law a couple of years ago, sales of assault weapons and copycat-style AR-15s have stopped here in Massachusetts. I'm going to continue to do my job as Attorney General. My job is to enforce the law, and we'll just be dealing with this in court, I guess, through the litigation, should they choose to pursue it. But I wish that instead of litigating and suing, that the NRA and the gun lobby would actually come to the table and be part of solutions that would move us forward when it comes to public safety and public health. Because this is not about grabbing guns or undermining people's Second Amendment rights. We've been able to do that here in Massachusetts, respect the Second Amendment, and ensure that we're enforcing laws that are there to protect public health and public safety. But, you know, unfortunately, we haven't seen that yet from the gun lobby.
Maura, one last question about guns before we go to the calls at 877-301-8970. You mentioned the police chiefs. We were talking to the governor the other day about whether or not he supported a red flag law, a term we were not aware of until recently, and five states currently have it, including Connecticut. Bill is pending in Massachusetts, which would allow a family member or law enforcement to go before a judge and get an extreme risk protection order saying an individual is a danger to himself or his community or her community, and their guns, their weapons would be taken away. Governor Baker's position was, and this is what made me think of it, that the power that police chiefs have in the state, not just to grant permits, but to take them away, was enough. And he didn't say we didn't need a red flag law as such, but suggested that current law was enough, I think, is fair to say. Where are you on this?
Well, I think everything should be on the table. And in fact, I think some recent comments from the NRA suggest that even they endorse the view and support some of these laws, which are fundamentally about keeping guns out of the hands of people who are a danger to themselves or to others. That makes a lot of sense to me, and I think it makes a lot of sense to the majority of Americans. I've advocated for an extreme risk protective order law here in Massachusetts.
So you're in favor of it.
Absolutely, because, you know, to me this is common sense. Why do we want to give somebody who we know to be an immediate danger to themselves or to others a gun? Or if they have a gun, don't we want to, for their own sake, you know, if we care about saving lives here, which to me this is what it's all about, and that's why I am so frustrated by the continued rhetoric and the lack of action and the gutlessness and the cowardice of those in Congress who don't seem to understand that they serve the people. When you have to listen to little kids who go home and talk to their parents about mass shootings, who return from schools in Massachusetts having participated in active shooter drills, those drills are necessary. But what kind of world are we in? Imagine the trauma these kids regularly here in Massachusetts are going through when they're taught what to do when somebody enters their classroom with a gun looking to mow them down. So, yeah, all these proposals should be on the table, and I think that there are many that just make common sense.
Ted and Southie, you've been very patient. You're first with the Attorney General, Maura Healey. Thank you so much for calling. Hi, Ted.
Good afternoon, Jim and Marjorie and Maura. And the best of luck with all of this, with these young people. Myself and four of my friends that served in the Marine Corps together, we happen to know a lot about weapons, are going to be marching in support of all of this insanity. So the best of luck, and my prayers are there. But I'm calling you for something different, Maura. I know it's landing on your desk, and you probably wish at that time you were elsewhere, but what are your plans to deal with this criminal enterprise, which is what the Massachusetts State Police have become? Sadly, I mean, I have so many friends in law enforcement, and it's mind-boggling. I would think, you know, there have to be indictments coming down on the most recent stuff.
Are you talking, Ted, just for the audience, Ted, are you talking about those who claimed 21, I think, who allegedly claimed overtime and got paid for which they didn't work?
Yeah, specifically, Jim.
Okay.
I mean, but the build-up to it has been horrific. But, yeah, let's just start with which is an obvious indictable offense. So
let's find
that's
out
what I'm calling, Maura.
Great. Thank
all right,
you, Ted. What do you think,
Maura? Appreciate the call.
Healy, excuse me.
It was what?
I used your first name.
I'm so proud of you.
No, he can do it. I don't. No, it's not a – don't even
okay.
start.
So, Ted, thanks for the call. It was great to be – I was over at the St. Patrick's Day breakfast the other day in Southie. That was a lot of fun. Let me tell you, really important issue here. Obviously, that particular matter about the use of overtime or the alleged misuse of overtime has now been referred to my office. It is the subject of investigation, and we will proceed through that expeditiously and thoroughly. But, you know, Ted, you and I know, and I don't know where you've, you know, worked in the past, but unfortunately, if you get a few bad apples doing a few things wrong, it ends up sort of coloring the whole organization or whole employment situation, and that's not good. I defend and respect the rights of the men and women who serve admirably and so well in the state police. Unfortunately, we know over the last year there have been a few instances that have come to light that absolutely need to be addressed. People need to be held accountable. The public deserves to have the utmost trust and integrity and belief in the integrity of the state's top law enforcement agency. So I am about ensuring that. I'm glad to see that Colonel Gilpin has taken the steps that she has taken to address these different issues that have come to pass and have come up. And we've got a few of these matters under current investigation in my office, so I'm limited in what I can say. But I want to make clear that we need to support those who are doing right and support the men and women in law enforcement, but take very seriously any one who will undermine the integrity of that operation, because fundamentally it's a matter of public trust and public integrity and making sure that those who are in positions to serve the public, we're all public servants, are doing that lawfully and are doing that well.
Ted, thanks.
You're not investigating the police officer, I believe his last, it was Sheehan, correct? Allegedly posting all the terrible racist stuff and the misogynistic stuff. Is he in your office as well?
No, that's currently a matter of state police internal investigation.
Okay, because that's one of the things that I find so upsetting is that he was posting these things on a cop website for quite some time. So it doesn't take far to deduce that there's a certain culture there and that people knew he was doing this. And you can't imagine, if I were the mother of a 20-year-old black kid, I would be hysterical about the prospect that there are other state cops who think the way this guy does, or, a young woman. I mean, I even know in my own family instance where I thought, why are the state police treating people in my family the way they've treated them for minor kinds of things, this really aggressive, macho thing, and plus the fact they're 90% white. I know we have to take veterans, and I get that, but there seems to be just this difficulty there. We have this story now that was in the Herald, the Boston Herald, talking about, and the Daily Download as well, talking about this dispatcher, a 19-year veteran dispatcher who was doing inappropriate things from the dispatch perspective and had done it before and apparently is still there doing these kinds of things. So there's a big problem here, it seems to me.
Well, I think there is a problem, a significant problem, and my hope and my expectation is that that gets addressed. Again, it is no good for anyone when we have this kind of situation, and that's why I'm glad the colonel is taking what appear to be very strong steps. We're going to do our work in the Attorney General's office.
We probably have
three matters currently under review and investigation. And I think tone and culture are incredibly important. And I think that those things need to be addressed and nipped in the bud when they emerge. And I also do think the point about diversifying policing is important. It's something that I know many are working on. But it's really important that we have a police force that not only reflects the communities that we serve, but also that is not marred by a few within an organization that do bad things.
Very quickly, you said you're investigating three things vis-a-vis the state cops. What besides the overtime?
Well, I think, as you know, publicly reported has been the allegations with respect to the treatment of Ali Bibo
matter. The daughter of that judge. What's the third one?
We'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay. Seth, is that you, Seth? Seth, can you turn on the mic, please, in the Newsfeed Cafe? Seth, you're on with the Attorney General. Welcome.
Hi, yes. Attorney General Haley, I am wondering what plans you have in the event that President Trump tries to withhold funding for sanctuary cities,
okay,
such as Boston and Salem.
Thank you, Seth.
Hey, thanks, Seth. Appreciate the question. Obviously, we'll do our job and stand up for the rights of Massachusetts. Unfortunately, we've continued to see over the last year or more actions by this president that are illegal, that are unconstitutional, that threaten the health and the well-being of residents here in our state, that threaten our businesses, that threaten our economy. So we don't take any of that lightly. We saw what he recently did with the state of California and how California is working to vigorously challenge that action. And certainly we would be in the same position. We don't have a state sanctuary law, however, so we have to see what happens. But, you know, there's a lot of talk, Seth, and there's a lot of rhetoric, and there's a lot coming out every day from that administration. And I think it's just important, too, that we keep doing our job, stay focused on what we need to do here, and that means enforcing laws that the Department of Justice should be enforcing but isn't. I mean, every day we learn more about the U.S., your U.S. government. Remember, this is our government that we pay for, and right now we have a Department of Justice headed by Jeff Sessions that is not only abdicating responsibility, they're not enforcing laws that are on the books to protect our environment, to protect consumers or workers or students or civil rights. What's worse is they're actually doing things that undermine the ability of a state like us and an attorney general to enforce state laws that are on the books. So it's one thing to sort of, you know, not do your job. It's worse and compounded by the fact that they are in courts right now trying to fight me and say that I don't have the right, I don't have the prerogative, I don't have the authority to enforce state laws. It's outrageous. The good news is, though, we've been winning in court. We're going to continue to do what we need to do. But I think when it comes to the issue of the threats around immigration, I think you've seen a steadiness and a lot of cohesiveness among elected officials in Massachusetts, law enforcement officials in Massachusetts, and immigrant community leaders who recognize that we understand firsthand how to protect public safety, public health within our communities, and we're going to continue to work together to do just that.
Seth, thank you for your call. Before we take a break, the most email we've gotten by far today while you're here is about Cambridge Analytica.
Yes.
And when you and Eric Schneiderman, your colleague in New York State, have talked about opening investigations, reaching out to Facebook. When you tell us what you're doing, the one thing I'm particularly interested in, and I think at least a few of the emailers are too, we had this discussion after Equifax with you. What drives me the most nuts is that Zuckerberg the other day never addressed the issue of why, when he found out about this in November, in the late 2015, he didn't choose to tell as many of the 50 million users that he could that their information had been mined. When you're answering, if you can just tell us what the state of the law in the state and federally is on an obligation, if there is one on the part of these companies, to let us know when our data is either breached or compromised.
Yeah. So if you're a company and you know that your data has been breached, information has been breached, you have an obligation to notify consumers about that.
You
do. You have an obligation to notify the state attorney general's office. Mm. Here, there's a question. This is why we're doing an investigation. I don't yet know the answer to this question as to whether or not this was a breach mm-hmm. under our law or not. That's what we're trying to find out. But, you know, Friday that news was published in the New York Times that detailed this relationship between Facebook and this researcher who later was giving that information, that data, to Cambridge Analytica. And so we immediately opened an investigation. We have been in contact with Facebook several times over the last week. They are producing documents to us, producing information to us, and have been cooperative. But this is a serious investigation, and we're going to be thorough and aggressive about this. To me, you know, it really raises some serious questions that we have to grapple with as a country, as a world right now. We're talking about a platform with billions. I mean, the scale of this is incredible. Billions of users. And I think all of us, when we go online, we have some understanding that, particularly when we're on a social networking site, that we're giving up certain privacy with that. I mean, we know that information is mined and used by different entities. However, there's a difference between that and a system that appears to have been wide open and quite vulnerable to exploitation. And at some point, these companies have a responsibility to take reasonable steps to better protect user privacy. We have a lot of questions. We need a lot of answers, but our office is going to continue to work with others in law enforcement here and abroad to get to the bottom of this.
Mm-hmm. We're talking to Attorney General Maura Healey. She's taking your calls, and we'll get to many more of your calls when we get back. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. If you're just tuning in to the bottom of the hour, we're joined by the Attorney General, as we are once a month, every month. Maura Healey, you can call her at 877-301-8970.
As promised, let's take some calls. Laura in Essex, thank you for calling.
Hi, Laura.
Hi, Jim and Marjorie. I'm a big fan of your show.
Thank you.
So I have a question. We have a new house that we just moved into in October, had a AC heating unit put in. It hasn't worked for more than a week since we've moved in. We have no heat. We have three children under the age of five that now play in their winter jackets in our home. I know, it's crazy. The stuff itself is guaranteed by the company, but only if the person that installed it comes out and fixes it. And my husband calls this one particular company every day, two times a day. He might come out, my husband will call him. He doesn't get back to my husband for weeks at end. He might come out, does a temporary fix. We have heat for 5 hours, and then it's off again for 3 weeks. So do we have any course of action that we can take here?
Yeah, absolutely. We'll get right on it, Laura. Stay on the line.
Thank you.
And we'll get your number. But also for listeners, I want you to know that this is the kind of stuff you can call my office about. My consumer hotline is 617-727-8400. And, I've got a team of folks who are there taking calls who will pick up the phone and call back to the company or call back to the home contractor and try to take care of a situation. So I am so sorry. I'm looking outside today, and it's sunny, but it's still, I think it's deceptively cold still. And you and your kids don't deserve that.
Laura,
so
that's
Laura, don't go
stay
away.
Stay on the line, and we'll see what we can do, Laura, okay?
Laura's on hold. Our producer will get the number and give it to the Attorney General. Thank
Rebecca
you very much.
In the car. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks. I'm a longtime fan, proud owner of Smug Mug. I'm calling to thank Maura Healey. I'm a member of Moms Demand Action, and I can't thank you enough. You are, like, such my hero, and you've been such a great inspiration. I saw you at the Women's Rally. My daughter and I saw you there. I saw you at the State House for ERPO. I guess my call is just to say that I've been participating in small community sort of conversations, trying to express our desire to get ERPO, the red flag law, passed, and in front of teenagers and having them participate. And I had this one conversation, and it just broke my heart because, this is why I think people like you are such an inspiration to keep going, because the conversation was centered around, a gun owner living in a home with a person in crisis, and their comment to me was, well, I didn't do anything wrong. Why should they come and take my gun away? And they said, well, if something happened, then that gun should be taken away from me. And I wanted to stand up in front of these kids and scream, what about the dead person? Like, did you skip over the person who could be a potential harm to themselves or to others? It was so mind-boggling for me. And I thought, I can't have conversations with these people anymore. I'm just going to keep planning events and working for legislation. And I just want to thank you.
Yeah, Rebecca, I appreciate it. And I appreciate that you're having conversations with young people and people in the community. I think that is just so important. And just keep at it and know that we will. And look, I mean, the idea that the president has to arm teachers is just ludicrous. There are more than 30 studies that show that the presence of guns is going to result in that much greater a likelihood of death or injury. Same thing when it comes to the presence of a gun in a home when there's domestic violence. We do need more studies, actually. That's one thing that to me is common sense. Congress should act right now to allow the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to study gun violence. Why? Because maybe somebody like me in law enforcement can employ better prevention and anti-violence strategies. But realize that that has been in place per the NRA and the gun lobby. Congress has banned the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from studying what is among the most lethal of consumer products, and has banned the CDC from identifying strategies that would help reduce violence. So keep talking to people, Rebecca, and keep people engaged on this issue. As I talk to people here and around the country, there is a lot more commonality around some basic common sense measures that should be taken.
Thank you very much, Rebecca, for your comments. 877-301-8970, Marjorie.
Let us go to Judy in the car. Hi, Judy in the car.
Hello, Judy in the car.
And 60% sorry, Judy. The other thing is, people, to that last caller's point, 60% of the gun deaths in this country are suicide.
Right.
Yeah.
So, I think about the obligation I have to look after, you know, my fellow sisters and brothers, right? It's like, at what point do we just give up and engage in a callous disregard for life? How can we, in the face of known danger and threats, not take steps to help somebody? And that's what a lot of this stuff is about.
Take it away, Judy. You're on.
Okay. Hey, Maura. You know who this is?
Judy?
Yeah. Hi there.
Hi, Judy. What's up?
I haven't seen her in about 2 weeks. First of all, I just want to start out by paraphrasing a mathematical theorem, and that is that where there's a will, there's a way. Where there's a Maura, there's a will. Therefore, where there is a Maura, there is a way. You'll pardon my putting it in those terms, but I have been on board supporting her since she first started running for AG, and I have to say that she has the capacity, the supporters, and the ability to run for other offices at a higher level, but her dedication to what she's doing and the seriousness of her commitment to it have kept her where she is by her own choice. And people don't know that necessarily. They need to understand, because a lot of people say, why didn't she run for governor? She could have beat Charlie Baker. Well, you know what? Maura feels, and I agree, she's doing such important work that she needs to stay where she is and continue to do the thing that she knows is, needs to be done. But I also want to...
That's a pretty tough question, yeah. Judy, I'll tell you.
Do you have a question there?
Thanks for the support, Judy.
Yeah, it's wonderful support, but do you have a question for the AG?
Yes, I just want to know, and I'm from the generation of duck and cover when the enemy was another country.
Yeah.
Was Betsy DeVos at any of these get-togethers in Washington?
No, I mean,
thank you, Judy.
Yeah, I mean, the Betsy DeVos is really, I think, a pathetic showing in terms of a public servant right now. Some may have watched the 60 Minutes interview other day. I mean, it is just her complete lack of familiarity with education, with public education, with the true needs of students and families across this country, her ignorance of Title IX laws, yeah, her ignorance of laws that are in place to protect kids with students with disabilities. It is truly appalling. It's why my office has had to do more work than ever. We have sued the DeVos administration a bunch for their failure to take steps to protect students from predatory practices.
Yeah, the fraud and abuse stuff. Explain that a little bit, because I find that incredible.
For years, we, as an office, you know, standing up for consumers, we've gone after some of the shady, predatory for-profit schools that were marketing to low-income folks or marketing to veterans with GI Bill money, getting them to attend really sham institutions. And what ended up happening is they get these students signed up. They think they're getting a great certificate or a great degree. All they're left with is boatloads, like tens of thousands of dollars in debt. So we went after them, shut some of them down, and then we also started to go after some of the loan servicers out there that were servicing these bad debts. And one of the things that happened along the way is we actually got an agreement with the Obama administration that said, look, if you've been the victim of a fraud or victim of a predatory practice in this space, you're entitled to a discharge of those student loans, which only makes sense. If you've been the victim of fraud, you shouldn't be on the hook.
Exactly.
Student loan debt, unlike other forms of debt, is not dischargeable in bankruptcy. It stays with you your entire life. It has huge consequences on your financial future. Sure enough, Betsy DeVos comes in, rips up that agreement, rips up the rules that were set in place to ensure that these bad actors weren't going to be allowed to operate in the space. Is it surprising? No. She doesn't know a thing about education that's of any consequence. And two, the people she put in charge of the U.S. Department of Ed all came from that for-profit school industry. So they're the ones writing the rules. So this is why people ask me, why are you suing the Trump administration? Why are you suing the Trump administration? Well, because they're screwing the American people. And they're hurting students. And I'm not going to let that happen here in Massachusetts. And
that's a legal term for those of you.
Yeah, well.
So, Maura Haley, can we go to
it? I'm sorry. This stuff it just really, really bothers me. Because, again, these are people who are supposed to be working for the U.S. taxpayer. And all they're doing is bilking it and raking it in and aggrandizing the pockets of a select few at the expense of all the rest of us. And it is just shameful what is going on right now across some of these federal agencies, whether you're talking about Scott Pruitt, Ryan Zinke, you know, who wants to open up our shores right now to offshore drilling. Give me a break. Or Betsy DeVos.
Maura Haley, can we change gears for 1 second?
Sure.
For those three people who don't
calm
know.
Me down?
No, I am going to calm you down.
You just gave me some chamomile tea here.
So we found out that
really?
One other great college basketball player, great maybe too strong, had Virginia winning the whole NCAAs. That would be Charlie Baker. And, of course, the first number one seed to ever get knocked out in the first round. How are your brackets doing? By the way, Maura Healey is a former professional basketball player, for those of you who don't know, when she was young and irresponsible. So how are you doing on the old bracket?
Terrible.
Oh, you are?
But I was so happy. My black bracket blew up the, I think that very, midway through that first Friday evening. So we had Thursday games, Friday games. I was blown up by midday Friday. But I was psyched about that because there were so many great upsets.
It was great. You know? It is great. That's it was great last night, too.
I know, and that's what you want about March Madness. I will say that my little poke has been that it's nice that the men finally caught up to the women. Because 20 years ago, a woman's number 16 seed defeated a number one seed.
Harvard University,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, they beat Stanford. And so it took the men another 20 years, but it's nice they've finally accomplished that.
Were you there? When were you?
No, I'm too old. That was long after my time, and I was not that good.
You know, so you're doing poorly, too. Okay, well, that's the end of that. So non-disclosure agreements. We all, actually on television the other night, I interviewed State Representative DeVoglio, who was the woman who stood up and said that she had been subjected to one she thought unfairly. People, I think, know that story. Both she and Angelo Scascia, who also criticized the speaker, despite, I think, what is generally perceived, including by DeVoglio, to be some very good new rules in the House of Representatives, said they'd look like the Attorney General look into non-disclosure agreements. You were asked about it at the St. Patrick's Day breakfast, and I think you said something like you're not fully up to speed on the facts yet. Are you now, and will you be involved at all in looking into these issues, or no?
Well, I think we understand some of what's gone on here in terms of the use of these agreements. Here's what I think is important. Right now, the House has adopted new policies and reforms that I think were much needed and are really good step. I also think recently the action last week that the House took to address specifically the use of non-disclosure agreements is important. Mm-hmm. And basically what it does is allow the use of non-disclosure agreements to lie in the hands of a complainant or a plaintiff coming forward. See, the context for non-disclosure agreements, let me say this, they should never, ever be used to silence or harass victims, period. Okay, but there are uses and there are instances where a plaintiff may want to have an NDA in place. You've seen this in the corporate context, in employment context, in any number of situations where there may be instances where maybe a victim doesn't want something publicly known.
We've seen
known.
In the Senate the people who are accusing Stan Rosenberg's estranged husband, some of them, as you know, were concerned about their identities being disclosed.
I think, you know, look, we work a lot with victims, and I'm sensitive to the needs of victims in terms of, you know, concerns about these things. But that's why I think allowing alleged victims or plaintiffs to be the ones to say whether or not an NDA should be in place is a good move. But I'm going to continue to be available as an office, as a resource, and certainly if there are instances of alleged sexual assault, sexual harassment, I ask that people continue to come forward to my office.
But if I just can stay on this for a second, while the speaker has said he knew nothing, Speaker DeLeo knew nothing about the underlying sexual harassment that DeVoglio has claimed in the legislature, he goes on to say, and none of the 33 NDAs that were struck during my time involve sexual harassment. She disagrees with him, obviously, vis-a-vis her one of 33. Have you considered looking into that, number one? And number two, if he believes that hers had nothing to do with sexual harassment and she disagrees, is it not possible some of the other 32 have to do with sexual harassment, even if his disagreement is good faith? Is that not a place for you, or is it?
You know, well, look, I think the first place for this is in the House, and I think that, you know, there are... I'm happy to having a conversation. Happy to have a conversation with anyone about this.
Did she reach out to you, by the way?
No,
she has not.
No,
okay.
And I've not been asked to look at it. We were asked as an office. We were consulted about the kinds of policies and reforms that might be needed going forward. And, you know, I was happy to lend my team's assistance on that and input into the work that, that Martha Coakley was heading up on behalf of the House. We're going to continue to be available as a resource. And as I say, I do have a matter pending before my office that we're working through right now as relates to alleged misconduct at the State House.
Fair enough. Want to go back to the calls?
Yeah, we're talking to the Attorney General of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, Maura Healey. David from Belmont. Thank you for calling, David.
Hello, David.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'm a psychiatrist, and in fact, I was happy to work with the Attorney General Healey's task force on guns and medical professionals.
Oh, great.
It was a lot of good work product. I have a question about the problems with HIPAA, so I don't mean to explain something in my question that Attorney General Healey obviously knows, which is the police, one gets one's license at the discretion of the local chief of police. But the problem occurs when physicians know about the dangerousness of a patient to have a gun, either on an emergency basis, say someone is threatening and grossly ill or drinking and has guns, or on a chronic basis, someone is, say, dementing and has guns and really can't work their toaster. And uniquely, it's the physicians who cannot express their concern to the local chief of police, who's the licensing authority, because of HIPAA, which requires the threat to be not only serious, but also imminent. Mm-hmm. So my question would be if there would be a way to change the statutes so physicians, in cases that were serious but not necessarily imminent, could contact the police to express concern about the patients having access to guns. And then the other piece of it would be not to have a perverse incentive. So as you see in states where physicians are allowed to report to DMV about dangerous drivers, physicians being defensive are going to tend to over-report. But if physicians were immunized not only for breaching confidentiality, but also failure to breach with regard to civil and regulatory sanctions, then there would be no perverse incentive and you'd be relying only on the best judgment of physicians. And when I say physicians, I mean physicians and licensed clinicians.
Great question.
Those are great questions. Yeah.
Thank you, David.
Yeah, David, and I want to thank you for your work with our office. We tried something new and innovative here in the state, which was to engage the medical community in a discussion about gun safety and how to talk with patients about the presence of guns or gun safety. You know, and the reason that I was inspired to do this was because Florida had a law in place, if you can believe it, that actually banned doctors from talking to their patients about guns.
Which, and even little kids.
And it got overturned, by the way, in court. Here's why that made no sense to me. You know, our doctors are talking regularly at pediatric visits about vaccinations and the use of seatbelts and the presence of electrical outlets in the home. So to say that they should be prohibited from talking among them about the most lethal of consumer products seemed ludicrous to me. But we had a really good conversation that we started that teased out some of the real issues with respect to privacy and HIPAA and the obligations that healthcare providers have in terms of confidentiality. And it's my hope that these are exactly the kind of issues that we can work through together, because at the end of the day, it's about saving lives. And David knows as a psychiatrist, there are instances where, you know, it's appropriate to breach patient confidentiality when that person may pose a risk of causing harm to themselves. We've got to be able to work through this together, and that's why I love to see everybody at the table trying to do just that.
You know, here's a question.
Thank you, David, for your call.
Yeah, thank you, David.
Of guns from Al, who asks, how is it legal for Dick's Sporting Goods, Walmart, et cetera, to refuse to sell a legal product to people who are legally able to purchase them? This is not Massachusetts, obviously, because of the group they belong to. He thinks that age is a protected class, and he refers to you can't do that with a wedding cake in some states. Is age a protected class?
Well, age, there are certain age restrictions on the purchase of all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Cigarettes alcohol, R-rated movies, so that's not an issue.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
Well, but wait a second. Isn't it possible? Marjorie and I had this discussion off the air the other day around the Florida raising a level from 18. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know enough about the law to know if for it to be a constitutional violation, does it need to be a protected class? But isn't there an argument to be made? I hope this is not sound, but isn't there an argument to be made that it's an arbitrary distinction here to pick 18 vis-a-vis, 21 as the appropriate age to purchase certain weapons, and it may be violative of the Second Amendment? Isn't that a colorably possible argument?
One can make that claim, but I don't think it's going to be successful. There are certain rules even in place when it comes to fundamental rights. I mean, constitutionally, if you want to talk, it's Second Amendment, fundamental right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about. I'm just reciting what I read.
Everywhere,
the government is allowed to set limits and draw lines, and certainly there are higher requirements that the government needs to meet when you're drawing certain lines around race or gender, and age. You know, is something that has been challenged in different contexts. I'm just saying here, I think it's perfectly permissible to draw those lines, and stores can decide. Look, at the end of the day, stores could decide what they want to sell, and I think that what stores are responding to, just like what pension funds are responding to and investment banks are responding to, is the realization and the demand by the American people for more accountability in this space and the need to take steps to reduce or limit some of the carnage we've seen.
Hey, will you consider giving us a buzz tomorrow? We're going to be on the air from 1 to 3. I'm serious. From the march, if you can.
I'd love to.
If you could call in, we'd love to hear from you.
Sometimes they shut down cell phone service in an area. But
if you can, we'd love to hear your impression.
I'd love to, because part of it's being down there and showing up and representing Massachusetts. Good. And look, there's more work we have to do here in this state to end violence. We see it every day. We read about it in the news. We wake up to it in the morning. And my heart goes out to all the victims of violence, all the survivors here. We've got to continue to work on this. I just think now is a particular moment in time in our country. There's tremendous energy. There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of initiative. And there's a lot of mobilization. And at least for me in government, while I'm in government, my job is to make sure that I'm looking out for people and working together to try to make life a little safer and a little healthier. And a little happier for everyone.
Good luck tomorrow. We hope to talk to you.
Thanks
Maura
a lot.
Healy,
Thank you
thanks
very
so much for your time. Attorney General Healy.
Attorney General Maura Healy. She joins us every month for Ask the Attorney General. Thank you again for your time. Coming up, Callie Crossey is here to explain why Boston's food truck culture is stuck in the breakdown lane. And we really want to get to the bottom of that. Let me tell you, she is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. The Attorney General is hanging out with our quiz guests. We'll get to them in a little while. Joining us, who is joining? Oh, I know who's joining. Oh, actually, Marjorie, here's a question for you first.
What's that?
What am I holding in my hand as I speak? What would that be?
You are holding the Callie Crossey sandwich, which
exactly.
both of us had for lunch, and Callie's having one herself.
And speaking of the Callie Crossey sandwich, the person after whom the sandwich is named is host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossey. Congratulations
Thank
on
you.
Your sandwich. What
Thank
do you think?
You.
What is it?
It's applewood bacon with Ooh. Lettuce and tomato, avocado, and spicy mayo.
You know how to live. Let me just tell you right now.
Congratulations. No, it's very good. It's very good. Yeah. I could have used a little bit more of the spicy mayo because
I really
like mayonnaise.
Me too.
So next time I'll ask for extra mayo, but it is very delicious. The bacon's really good. They have really good bacon here at the Newsfeed Cafe.
They have very good food here, actually.
I've eaten more bacon since I started to broadcast out of here. Okay, so let's talk about two kind of, I suppose you could call it, white privilege and wealth privilege stories.
Yeah, crazy.
Remember the affluenza kid from years ago?
Yeah.
Tell us the story of the affluenza teen, Ethan Crouch, who's no longer a teenager. What's happened to him?
Well, he's 20 years old. He's been in jail since, he was charged. People may know that, I thought it was his attorney, but some people said it was somebody else that named him. Named him the affluenza teen because his attorney said he didn't know the difference between right and wrong because he was so affluent.
Right.
And his crime was he was driving drunk down a street and killed four people. So his the attorney went to court and tried to argue that just because he was living a privileged life, that he was just unable to determine, you know, a moral standard, so to speak, and so that's why this happened. That didn't fly. But they did, but actually they put him on probation, which a lot of people was like, oh really? And then he was supposed to not stay away from alcohol during this probationary period, if you recall. People were outraged about the sentence. And then there was some tape that surfaced showing him indulging in alcohol. And so then at that point they grabbed him and put him in the slammer. But that was after he and his mother escaped to Puerto Vallarta, which is where they found them, no doubt at a resort there.
Yeah, so, yeah. You know, when I heard about the mom sort of complicit in his crimes, yeah. Maybe he did grow up really confused. Well, if mom thinks the solution is to flee the country.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it's in crazy. Puerto Vallarta, so they were in some comfort while they were there.
Yeah, and
but he's getting out April the 2nd. That's what we're talking
can
about.
Can I tell you, this story from the time, I don't want to belabor this. This is right up there in the injustice things of all time.
Yes, it is.
The fact that this young man got probation because of this completely BS defense is disrespectful to the families of those people.
Four people did.
Well, Kelly Crossey, there is a big March for Our Lives on Saturday here and all around the country. You wrote, and I wrote, as it turns out, both about the kind of double standard, the white privilege thing, but the kids from Parkland, which is not only mostly white kids, but mostly privileged kids, they've recognized this double standard themselves.
We should say that that Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School is really actually has quite a diverse student population. We'll recall that Emma Gonzalez actually is Cuban. One of the young people that was killed was Peter Wang, and that's something I mentioned. But with that said, the people who've been in front are the white kids, and they've just come into recognizing that part of what they've been a part of has had some racial implications as they've gone out across the country to talk to other students about being a part of their movement. You know, they I'm sure they knew, but they didn't really understand to the extent of how many other people have been working on this issue and how important an issue it is of gun violence in communities of color. And they just didn't get those kids, however, those young people did not get the same kind of response. And so David Hogue is one of the ones that people will recognize, and he stepped forward. There have been some others saying the same thing, to realize that, hey, we got to use our white privilege to bring some light to what's happening there and make people understand that our general issue is that there should be school safety and that we should be free of gun violence and wherever it is, and recognize that people have been working in those communities for some time to make some
changes. But you know what is a tough one? Because if they are successful, and who knows if they are successful in one of their chief things, banning assault weapons, that the majority of the violence in communities of color is with handguns.
Yeah.
And so you wonder how, you know,
for one thing, they have a whole range of issues that they want to have addressed, not just with assault. That's one of their things. But I would argue they've already been successful. So that's something that the other groups are looking at saying, wow, you've already got corporate response right away.
Yep.
I mean, it's been 5 weeks, people. You've already got some political response. It may not be what they want just yet, but they've got some. Listen, they made a movement in Florida. Florida was not a state nor the governor that was about to be responding to this in any other way, and that's happened. So they've achieved some level of success in that way, not to mention just getting all kinds of young people excited about this across the board. For my show on Sunday, one of my guests is Victoria Massey. She's an active member of Hyde Square Task Force. That's a very active group here in town. She's going to the march. She says she's inspired by them. She recognizes what her great work has done at organizing here, but she's too inspired by them. That's quite a success.
I said to Marty before, I've had 14 and 15-year-olds from Cambridge Region Latin, Somerville High, who are so together and so focused and so, you know, one of the key tests, by the way, about this thing, they went to Chicago, as we mentioned, and some of the leaders went to Chicago to try to diversify their movement.
They went to Anacostia, too, recently, yes.
The key question is what the face of these marches look like tomorrow. It's one thing to say the right words, and I trust that they mean them. What does the march look like in Washington and Boston?
Well,
there are 800 of them, theoretically, around the country.
There's two buses of young people going from Lipstick, the organization, which tries to keep young women from going to New Hampshire to these gun shows and buying guns for their boyfriends or brothers, whoever, who can't get them. They filled up two buses, and they're mostly young people. And I know Ruth Rollins' granddaughter and her son was killed in Boston. And she was only a baby at the time. She's 13 now. She's going down the bus to Washington. So there's a big contingent from Boston that's going to be
And people here, too, because Victoria is participating in the marches here with kids. So we'll see.
So, Kelly Crossley, this isn't the easiest transition, but since we all love food, and we started with a Crossley sandwich, if
that's
I may
right.
call it that,
yeah.
I was surprised to read this Boston Business Journal story about how we rank last of major American cities, I think I'm right about this, in terms of how difficult it is to get a food truck from concept onto a street. Were you surprised?
No, I wasn't, because this is the kind of conversation that a lot of, particularly when the last go-round in the mayor's race, not the last, but before, when there were 13 people running, this kept rising to the surface.
Yeah, it did, actually. You're right.
As an issue. And so I'm not surprised. There's 32 points of reference, 32 procedures to start a new truck in Boston and San Francisco.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just not...
Three times as many as Denver, it says.
Yeah, so
and how about this
crazy.
How about this? I thought we have to ask the mayor about this next time he comes, that they have to buy a GPS unit from the city's preferred vendor for $300, have it installed by that vendor.
For $89.
And then pay a monthly data charge of $35.
Right. This is work done by David Harris, by the way, of the Boston Business Journal.
I'm suspicious.
I mean, it's I'm not suspicious. It's probably happening. But that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. Yeah, my GPS didn't cost $300.
But, you know,
like
so,
$50.
You know, well, I'm not defending 32 procedures or whatever they are as compared to 10 in places like Denver. Some of these matter a lot. For example, one of the things, and I knew virtually nothing about this until I was reading the story, is you have to be, I think, in Boston at least 100 feet from a brick-and-mortar restaurant, which is only fair. I mean, if you're investing in the physical infrastructure, which is wildly expensive, and you're going to compete, which you essentially are, there's got to be some. So
but
some
I would
of these
assume
make
that that's part of every deal in every
that
city.
That is probably true.
You know,
that
so that's not true. The one. That one we'll take, but what's the other 31?
I don't know. Are you a food truck person?
I love food trucks.
I don't know why. Can you explain? Because I don't know why I love them.
Listen to you.
I love them. Well, because... so often the people that put them together do very innovative things with the food. They try something different. My first food truck experience, interestingly enough, was not here, but in California.
What was it?
Bun Mi.
Bun Mi's here too.
Oh my God!
Man.
I went to Bun Mi's till I couldn't eat anymore. I was just like falling
what is
over.
Bun Mi?
It's a Vietnamese sandwich.
Ooh.
But there's a lot of fusion often in the food on food trucks, and then because they do one thing pretty well. You know, then you get an opportunity to sample something. You know, when you're a foodie, you like that. I love
the
this.
Grilled
you know,
cheese, the grilled
cheese. Roxy's food truck.
Roxy now has, they have brick and mortar as well as trucks, by the way.
And that's happening with a lot of food
They have one.
People.
Do you ever drive by the one in Central Square where there's a line on the street between Central and MIT? There's a line on the street every single night. It's wedded to this gaming
what kind of
area.
Food?
Right.
Roxy's.
Oh,
Roxy's.
Oh, okay.
Okay, let me tell you a little secret.
Please. What?
So I went to the Somerville, has a food truck festival, huge one in the summertime. So a couple years ago I went. And, you know, if someone has barbecue, even though I know it's going to be horrible, I'm going to have to try it. So there was somebody with a food truck with barbecue. And the line was wrapped, because nobody gets any here. So the line was wrapped around. So I thought, now what could I do here? Let's pull a gym. So I went to the top of the line, the front of the line.
Oh,
and
I said
to some hungry-looking young people, listen, you can get whatever you want, but I need to get in front of you. How do you feel about that? One guy said, fine, because, you know, what does it cost? $5? So he, like, ordered up everything. I tasted it, and it was great. I didn't have to wait in line for hours and hours.
Well,
remember that.
I ordinarily
so
don't.
It was good.
It was okay.
It was okay.
It was okay. It was not. I would not.
Well, can I just say, I know you're a Memphis kid.
Yes.
But, and I know Northern barbecue is not Southern barbecue.
No, that is correct. Marjorie, actually, that is a misnomer, but go ahead.
You don't even consider it barbecue. Marjorie was there a week or two ago. I was there a month or two ago. Sweet Cheeks, which is one of Tiffany Faison's places, is fabulous. No?
That's not my favorite.
Well,
nope.
I'm loving it.
No.
Of course,
nope.
I'm not from Memphis.
Nope.
How about the biscuits?
Oh, the biscuits are fantastic,
and the
fried pickles are really good.
Oh, my God.
Yeah,
I could be
good.
Massaged with the biscuits, let me just tell you.
Well, the biscuits are as big as your head.
They are. With honey butter.
I will say that it's very difficult to achieve to have a tender biscuit that is part of the Southern thing, too, and to have it be as large as it is.
Yeah.
Because it'll either get too crumbly, you don't have the right texture, all of that.
You say it with such feeling.
Yes.
I went down to your neighborhood, though. I told you I went down to Beale Street and had barbecue down there, and it was a whole different
experience. That's what I'm trying to tell you.
Yeah, it was a whole different experience.
Come on, it's a methodology.
But I'm not sure the biscuits were as good at the place I went to on Beale Street. They do have good biscuits
right
there. They're nice and soft, and they're big, and they're moist, and oh, my God.
You know what the other food truck thing? I don't want to belabor this because we want to find out what you're doing Sunday night. But it's also, you associate with spring, don't you? And it's, you're outside, you're in a T-shirt or something, you're standing outside, even if you're waiting in line longer than you want to, and the weather's beautiful.
And if there's a whole bunch of them, you can sample around.
The whole experience is absolutely fabulous.
So you try the Somerville Food Truck Festival, is great. They have several weekends over
there. What are you doing Sunday night on Under the Radar?
I am doing a regional roundtable. We're talking about stories from around the region. One of them is about this legislation that's been introduced by a couple of people in Rhode Island to charge folks $20 to observe porn online.
I know. I thought that was
story.
A joke when I first read it.
No, no, it's not.
Okay,
it's
go
not.
Ahead.
No, so that's one. Other people may be interested to know that Providence, speaking in the same space, has just been named one of the hot happening places by Vogue.com.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So,
in what way?
You
mean just as a local?
Just so many different wonderful
fabulous.
Things happening.
Fabulous
with
place.
The, not just the food, but all the activities. And this was written by somebody who had gone to school at RISD and just came back and realized, wait a minute, I haven't, really looked at the whole Providence. And then in the second half, we're doing a thing, putting into context student-led activism.
Oh, great.
I was looking at the history of it, talking with the young woman I mentioned from Hyde Square Task Force, talking with also Peter Levine from the Tisch School for Civic Life about, what makes it work, what could undermine it, all that kind of stuff.
Great,
so,
for this weekend in particular.
Yes,
nice
absolutely.
To see you. Congratulations on the sandwich, Kelly.
Let me tell
you, I will.
You're looking great today. Color coordinated as always. How about that, Jim?
It's excellent.
What do you call that? What color is that?
It's kind of a chartreuse.
Chartreuse, okay.
Yeah, I love it.
Chartreuse scarf, bracelets, and glasses.
Oh, my
glasses.
God.
I try in my own humble way.
And brooch. Is it always I mispronounce it?
Yeah,
it's brooch.
Brooch, I would say.
Thank you, Kelly Crossley.
Kelly Crossley joins us every week. You can see her tonight on television and all that. Chartreuse at 7 o'clock with Emily Rooney at 7:30 on Basic Black at WGBH Channel 2. Callie's a host of Under the Radar. You can catch that Sunday nights right here on 89.7 at 6 o'clock and subscribe to her Under the Radar podcast on iTunes or follow her on Twitter at Callie Crossley. Up next, it is time for our Friday news quiz, a very sudsy edition with the Massachusetts Brewers Guild. They are next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. We are broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. It's time for a Friday news quiz, a hoppin' edition, says Jim, with Rob Burns. He's the co-founder of Night Shift and the president of the Mass Brewers Guild. Hey there, Rob. Good to see you. How are you?
Thanks for having me.
And Keith Sullivan, who is back yet again. We had him last year. Sully is a co-founder of Medusa Brewing. He's the vice president of the Mass Brewers Guild. And they're here primarily, other than to provide us with beer, is next month on Saturday, April 28th, is their Power Beer Fest. It'll be at the SOA Power Station in Boston South End. It'll showcase somewhere like 60-plus local breweries. Heaven for craft beer lovers. Sully and Rob, it's good to see you both. Thanks.
Okay.
Why was Maura Healey? I don't want to out her, but she said it herself. She came back to me to say, why was she cozying up to you two? Is she a fan of the breweries, or what's the deal, Sully?
Yeah, that's what she said. She said, we love your beer.
And you too?
Yep. Yeah.
So oh,
I think she was talking about Rob's beer.
That was pretty great.
Because so, you're up in Hudson.
Yeah, right? We're in Hudson.
Yeah. But so tell us about this this beer fest. I mean, I think I went to this last year. It was really fun and outside and sunny and all that kind of stuff. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, it's what's really cool is it's the largest gathering of Massachusetts brewers under one roof ever, because we beat our number from last year. And it's at the SOA Power Station. So in the afternoon, you get this great atmosphere. It's lively. It's open. People are having fun. There's music. There's beer. And then as the evening session starts, all those lights start coming on in the power station. And it's this just this magical, magical place.
And I love that you said there's beer. That's a good thing. Yeah. At a beer fest, I've always felt, Sully, having beer is important. Would you agree with that?
I completely agree with you, Jim.
Now, yeah. Rob, what you're supposed to do...
2,000 craft beer lovers is going to be... Oh, that was 2,000. Okay, excuse me. 50 breweries, 2,000 people showed up last year.
Yeah.
Now, okay. Rob, while you're answering our questions, you're supposed to say, Jim and Marjorie, why don't you sample what we brought while I'm answering your questions?
Yeah, we brought a great array of our beers that we make at our different breweries.
What'd you bring?
I brought Whirlpool, our pale ale, and Centilli, our award-winning IPA.
So just pour some, will you please? You know, one of the things, it seems to me with all these craft breweries, one of the key, not that I'm an expert, even though I love craft beer, and I've had both of your beers. They're both great. Night Shift is in Everett. Medusa in Hudson. Having these tap rooms is a huge part of how you invite in a new audience, Sully. Is that not a huge thing?
It's enormous. It's the best tool you have to not only figuring out what brands and what styles of beer people are into, but it's the best thing you have going in terms of selling your whole entire company, because you're not out there on your feet going to separate stores. You're bringing everybody to you and letting them experience it the way you want them
to. Same with you, Rob, over there in
Everett? Oh, absolutely. It's a huge part of our brand success and getting it in front of consumers and sharing it the way that we want it to be talked about and proper glassware, the right temperature, and everything. It provides the whole experience.
What are we drinking?
This is Centilli, our IPA.
Wow, that is incredible. Well, before we taste the other, we have our lifelines here today, Marjorie. I know you really want to know who they are,
do.
So I'm going to tell you. They are all from Ashland. Is that correct? Actually, a new Senate president is from Ashland, soon to be Senate president. Beatrice, who are you? Raise your hand. Thank you. Hi, Beatrice.
Hi.
Holly. Hi, Holly. Joanne. And Karen, by definition, you're Karen. Yeah. And the way the light, welcome and thank you guys for coming. The way this works, you two, is we'll ask you a question in a second. If you get it wrong, you may then ask for a lifeline, and one of these fine women from Ashland will give you a clue to help your pathetic self hopefully get the question right. And if you get it right, you don't need a lifeline, et cetera, et cetera. When is this thing, one more time before we start the quiz? What is this deal?
April 28th.
And what do you do, just buy a ticket?
Yep.
One ticket?
You can buy a ticket online. They're $55. And we also have designated driver tickets for sale as well.
Oh, that's
fine.
And by the way, and when you buy the one ticket, you can sample essentially everything, right?
Yep, as many as you can responsibly consume.
Okay.
What happens if it rains?
Good job, Rob.
It is covered, so we will be protected. It just won't be as
good.
Fresh.
Okay.
Okay,
right.
So wait
that's
a second.
Fine.
We tried Night Shift. Before we ask the first question, do you have a little Medusa stuff with you?
Yeah, we've got
what are we drinking?
Laser Cat Imperial IPA. We've got our Rye IPA Citra Legacy, our Cream Ale Luminary,
our
American IPA Prosperous, our Friendly Territory IPA, which is all Massachusetts ingredients, and then our Coffee Porter Activate.
Let's try the all Massachusetts ingredients. And by the way, design of beer cans is
They're
huge
beautiful.
These days.
Oh, yeah.
Is it not?
Yeah,
it's
beautiful.
A huge part of the deal.
I went to a wedding reception at your place. Night
oh, did you?
Yes,
great.
It was really, really fun. It was big
Laser
and cavernous,
cat.
And we're drinking beer, and they had all this food in there, and the band was there. It was really fun.
Okay, who are you starting with, Marjorie?
I was just talking to Rob. Why don't I start with Rob? You ready, Rob?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Okay. This week we learned that Lewis, an unusual gorilla at the Philadelphia Zoo who prefers to walk on two legs instead of all fours, shares something in common with President Trump. This is multiple choice.
This is dangerous.
Okay. Don't forget, we have a lifeline if you need it. A, he likes to show everyone the size of his hands. B, he's a germaphobe. Or C, his preferred order from McDonald's is a quarter pounder with extra ketchup, hold the pickles with a fried apple pie.
I feel like I should know this. I'm a Philly born and raised.
Well, so
yeah.
Am I.
But I, if I'm going to guess, I'm going to go with the cheeseburger.
Well, man.
C.
That
no.
is really sad. Okay, do you want a lifeline or not?
Yeah, I'll take a lifeline.
Who's the lifeline for Rob? Oh, yeah, okay. Karen, okay, what is it?
Okay, it is, let's keep it clean in here, folks.
Ooh. Does that help you at all?
Yeah, so the germ one, I think that was
the germaphobe. That is correct.
Can I think, you know, this story,
this
I don't
Medusa
know if anybody
beer
read this.
Is great.
I actually
this
read this
story. This is the
Medusa
story. Here. It's great.
Do you know how they know
yeah,
this?
Yeah, thank you.
When the ground is muddy or the gorilla has food, it walks upright, not on all fours, like it says here, like a human, because it doesn't want to get its hands dirty. Is that amazing?
It is amazing,
obviously,
Jim.
You don't think so. Okay.
No, it's a beautiful okay. thing.
Sully, you ready for your question?
I think so.
It's apparently another Donald Trump question. It's shocking. Donald Trump did not follow the advice of his national security advisors when they wrote, "Do not congratulate," in bold capital letters in his morning memo. Who was Trump told not to congratulate but did anyway? A, Mark Zuckerberg on Facebook's media coverage this week because all press is good press. B, Vladimir Putin on his election victory. Or C, the king of Wakanda for the new vibranium trade deal. Is it A, B, or C? What is it there, Sully?
That was B, Vladimir Putin.
Wow, ding, ding, ding. Okay, so that takes care of that.
Okay.
All right.
Here we
what
go,
is
Rob.
It, 1-1? Thanks. Thank
Here's
you
Here's question
much.
Three. Here is a clip from a video that went viral this week. Okay. This is a tough one. That is the sound of what? A baby being reconnected with its mother after United Airlines mistakenly sent the infant on a separate aircraft. B, the sound of the first polar bear cub born in the UK in 25 years. Or C, the sound of Jim Bradley when Marjorie refused to pick up his lunch at the Newsfeed Cafe.
Oh, man.
Thank you. Okay, we heard it the first time. Thank you, judges.
Okay, the baby reconnected with Mom, excuse me, the first polar bear cub born.
I'm going to go with the polar bear cub.
Ding, 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 ding. We don't need you yet, but thank you all for being here.
I do not believe I have an answer on here.
No, they just went ding, 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 which means it's yes.
All right.
So what are we drinking this time? What's this Medusa thing? What is it again?
That one is Friendly Territory. It's an Imperial IPA that we brewed with our friends from Four-Star Farms that grow hops in Northfield, Mass., and Valley Malt out in Hadley. So it's all Massachusetts ingredients, which is pretty cool.
Is this, do you guys worry, when I read that there's so many, what are there 150 craft breweries? Am I, Rob, you're nodding in agreement. This is like a radio show. You have to say yes.
Yeah. Sorry, yes, you're correct.
And there are 20 more that are on the verge of opening. Are you guys worried about flooding? I don't mean that as a pun, the market, or is the appetite for this as huge as you hope it is?
I think there is an appetite for more local brands and breweries. I think they really resonate well with the local community, and there's room for more of them. There's definitely not room for a ton of big, larger national brands, but I think if it's done right and they're producing quality liquids like Medusa, there's always room for more.
You know what's most exciting about this to me? Can I ask you, ordinarily we wouldn't do this, how old are you, Rob?
I'm 33.
How old are you, Sully?
33.
You know, almost every craft brewery owner or founder who we've had on the show in the last 2 years, late 20s or early 30s, it's unbelievable. It's really great.
You know what I wonder, because I generally don't like beer. If I was going to drink, I'd drink liquor or I'd drink wine or something. These beers are so different. And is it because, obviously, you're going to say the quality's better, but is it because they're not shipped from far away, or because why do they taste so much better?
There's certainly a freshness element to it that makes them real more lively and more robust. I mean, this one was packaged like a week and a half ago.
Really?
So it's more fresh than a lot. It's not traveling across the country on big trucks. We put a lot of emphasis on keeping our beers cold, all cold refrigeration in our warehouse and trucks that deliver the product around Boston.
I mean, there's almost like a flower taste to like this one that I'm. I don't know. I think this is yours from Night Shift that I'm drinking. I forget
like
which one.
Like floral, Vienna.
Yeah, which is so different, right?
Well, we're able to execute on, like Barab was saying, we can do things with ingredients that, you know, may not translate to the big breweries doing it in large volumes and maintaining that quality throughout, but we can do, at the smaller scale, we can do different things with like hops and yeast that, because people are drinking fresh, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
So that's the voice of Keith Sullivan. Keith is the vice president of this Mass Brewers deal. He's from Medusa in Hudson. And Rob Burns is the other guy here. He's the president of this nonprofit trade group for craft brewers. He's from Night Shift in Everett. Now, here's your opportunity to tie this up, Sully, before the bonus round. Oh, a boy. Children's book flipped the script this week, introducing an all-inclusive love story complete with an audiobook. Was it A, 100 Heart Acre Wood, a remake of Winnie the Pooh, wherein a passion develops between two friends, Piglet and Pooh?
I guess I should live. I suppose I shall live.
With me. You shall live with me. Won't you, Piglet?
With you? Oh, thank you, Pooh Bear. Of course I will.
I forget the question already. B, a remake of Marlon Brando's Day in the Life of the Vice President, where Vice President Mike Pence's pet rabbit declares his love for another male rabbit. That would be Wesley.
Wesley, I don't want to hop without you ever again. And Wesley said, that's funny, because I never want to hop without you, Marlon Brando, ever again. And we both said, we will get married and hop together forever.
Or is it C, Sesame and You, where Ernie and Bert, who doesn't love Ernie and Bert, finally reveal their true feelings?
And even though his silly tricks can drive us far apart,
I'll always have a special place for Ernie in my heart.
Love those guys. So is it A, B, or C, Sully? What's the answer?
I'm going to have to just totally guess A.
Well, thank God you're wrong, which means you want a lifeline?
I'll do the lifeline,
Who's
yeah.
the lifeline? Okay.
Joanne.
Joanne, come over to the mic. Joanne from Ashland, one of our four lifelines here today. Take it away, Joanne.
Not to rabbit in, but this book has been extremely popular, selling 180,000 copies in 2 days.
That is one of the best readings I've ever heard. Thank you very much. Does that help you at all?
B.
B is correct. By the way, if people don't know, this is John Oliver's book. He creates a gay version of this children's book created by Charlotte and Karen Pence. It is the number one bestseller in America. Do you know that?
No, I did not know that bestseller. Until you told me.
It's 2-2 before the bonus round. By the way, let's hear it for Beatrice, Holly, Joanne, and Karen, our lifelines from Ashland. Thank you, ladies. Thank you for coming. Did an incredible job.
Okay.
We're really short on time.
We are.
So here's the bonus round.
Bonus round real quick.
Our guest, we got to explain what it is.
Our guest know a thing or two about the Massachusetts Brewers Guild, or they should since they're president and vice president. Our bonus round will quiz them on a different but equally as important organization, the Magicians Guild of America.
Boy. Take it away.
Okay, Keith, here we go. Which of the following is true about Theodore Hardeen, the founder of the Magicians Guild of America? A, he was the first magician to escape from a straitjacket. B, he was the younger brother of Harry Houdini. Or C, he played the role of Miranda on Sex and the City and is now running for governor of New York.
A. I don't know.
Good guess. Good guess.
You know what it
you
is? You can steal the question, Rob. He wasn't paying attention. Why would he? I wouldn't pay attention
A, was magician from a straitjacket. B, younger brother of Harry Houdini. C, played the role of Miranda on Sex and the City and is now running for governor of New York.
I know you guys were talking about Sex and the City earlier today, but I think it's B.
You are correct. Younger brother of Harry Houdini.
Now, Rob, if you get this right, you win the whole thing. Let's be quick. Boy. Second president of the Guild was Richard Valentine Pitchford, a.k.a. Cardini. Practiced and honed his card manipulations while also doing what? A, resting indoors during his childhood, afflicted with chronic something or other. B, sitting in the trenches as a soldier during World War I. Or C, making White House staffers disappear from their positions with a snap of a finger. A, B, or C?
I'm going to go B.
That is correct. You are the winner. Rob Burns, congratulations.
Good
now,
game.
Gentlemen,
good fight,
before
Rob.
You go, one more time, whatever the hell this thing, Power Beer Fest. Sully, where and when and how do we get tickets?
April 28th at the SOA Popper Station. 1 to 4:30 is the first session, and then 6 to 9:30 is the second session. Tickets at massbrewersguild.org. We're still trying to get volunteers to help us set up and great. Break down.
Thank and you, you get to sample 60-some breweries, right?
Oh, yeah, times... 4, 5, 6 beers each.
Fabulous.
Oh, that's going to be... I'm getting my tickets right away. It's going
to
be really fun.
Gentlemen, thank you. It's great to see you
thank
again.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks for
Thanks
the beer.
For
it's great.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
I'm going to tell you guys one more time, if you're interested in this beer fest, after I reintroduce Rob and Keith. Rob Burns is co-founder of Night Shift and the president of the Mass Brewers Guild. Keith Sullivan is co-founder of Medusa Brewing, and he's the vice president of the Mass Brewers Guild. Next month, Saturday, April 28th, the Power Beer Fest at the SOA Power Station in Boston's South End. More than 50 local breweries. Heaven for craft beer lovers. To learn more about it, go to massbrewbros.com. That's massbrewbros.com. Thank you very much for listening
right,
to another edition.
Brewers Guild.
Massbrewersguild.com.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's right.
Massbrewersguild.com. Sorry
cool
about
too.
That.
We got it.
That's also
okay.
famous.
A quick heads up, the BSO has just announced their 2018-2019 season, so check that out at bso.org. You can also hear more about that with Brian McCreath on WCRB 99.5. We're going to be here tomorrow broadcasting from 1 to 3 for the march in Boston, the gun march in Boston. On Monday, all revved up. You can also catch up with us by loading down our... our podcast
we
and
call
iTunes.
It downloading.
Downloading,
but it's okay,
loading
whatever.
Down, downloading.
This is going
anyway,
well, I think.
It's going well. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, thank you all for coming. I want to say that. Thank you. Most importantly, 1 to 3 tomorrow, as Marjorie said, live. We'll be covering the march. Join us, call us, do whatever feels good.
That's right. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow. Please tune in if you are available for the march. We'll be here 1 to 3. Thanks.